The power of the media is great and growing. It has a very close relationship with politicians, I think a slightly incestuous one, each trying to influence the other, and it is a struggle for power. You see, wealth and power are indivisible. In the old days, it was land and factories. But now, it is really the control of information that is the greatest power that the wealthy have.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 12th of July 2024, streaming live from Eastone Studios in Bristol. Yes, we got in today. We actually got in and got set up before 5 o'clock. How about that? Which, with London's Inner Temples, one of several, Bristol that is, one of several Templar ports in the Empire of Lies. Yes, those very active Templars still busy. Keeping quiet though, behind the scenes. That was a Joe Biden, not a very good Joe Biden impression. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioqeuk.com in Camberley, Surrey. DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire. Radiosoapbox.com in Worthing, East Sussex. Also, if you've got an FM transmitter or medium wave transmitter, you can just plug this stream in. Let me know and we'll credit you here. So we could be going out as a pirate, who knows? On AM or FM anywhere in the world. So, and not to put ideas into you, of course that's all. Luckily, the DTI or whatever, we've got hardly anybody looking into these anymore, so you can pretty much do that sort of thing. Whereas in the old days, they were very strict about it. And of course, with digital, that's one of the reasons they've gone over to digital radio, is because it's far more difficult to do pirates. You remember in the old days when pirate radio was... Oh, well, I mean, we do, a lot of our older generation. Anyway, it's also available on Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which you can get from all good app stores, Aurora, please, rather than Google Play. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military propaganda psyops, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, the puff pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on the heroes, the McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against World War III and wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, farming, cost of living, climate, a new one every few months. The twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies craftily crafted to make every crisis worse. And the politicians have nothing to say. Nick Land's behaviourist Dark Enlightenment drones, the cowards and control freaks, want us as slaves to their machines. A bit more on that this week from Jules Evans. And Albert Pike's World War III slugfest relies on your blind obedience. Meanwhile, the wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and witch queen Camilla wage war on the British people, as well as China, Russia and the BRICS. With the Libya regime change maniac's sidekick Diddy David Cameron now out of the picture. Maybe they'll bring him back in. Oh, gosh, David Cameron, even though he's a Tory, oh, he was so good as Foreign Secretary. So anyway, helping us navigate the WEF's fourth industrial revolution, the Fourth Reich Matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And also, I think you're going to have to pronounce your surname, Matt.
O'Brannon.
Oh, that's easy enough. O'Brannon. That's Irish descent, is it?
Correct, yeah.
So, look, we're going to be going through all sorts of things this week, not least of which is this incredible announcement yesterday at the NATO summit by Keir Starmer that the Ukrainians were going to be able to use British long-range missiles to hit Russia, and then instantly countermanded by the Ministry of Defence in the Daily Telegraph saying, no, they won't. So quite who's in charge? Who knows? Anyway, Matt, lovely to have you in here. I came across you because you were you popped up on one of our what we call the Bristol Media Collective, Bristol MC, talking about Assange. Basically, you were jubilant about it all, which all of us were. But you actually were involved during the Assange campaign. I think this is the theme of this program: is we're not just sort of forgetting the Assange story. We're now looking back at people who were involved down the line through the campaign. And really, I suppose part of that celebration is reflecting on the successes. And one of those you were very much involved with, well, several.
Yeah, I've been campaigning for 5 years on it. It was definitely, it has been a big relief in a lot of ways. I mean, the fact that the guy's out, he's enjoying Australia and swimming and privacy and being with his lovely family. But while there's celebration and euphoria, there was also concern about the guilty plea and what does that mean? You know, what did he plead guilty to exactly? And I think we should talk about that too. But so it's not a perfect victory, but I think it's a historic win. I think it's a great win that'll echo through the ages.
Yeah. Okay. So you're a Kiwi. What are you doing over in the UK here?
Well, it was Julian's case that brought me over here, actually. While I was born here, in fact, I haven't been back here since I was 5, which is a minute ago, and it was very bizarre to be flying back home, what I thought, you know, was once home, after 35 years or so, to be coming back and see, like, why am I coming back? Because there's a freaking award-winning journalist in a maximum security prison. That was the last thing I thought that would bring me back to the United Kingdom, but there we are. That's why I'm here, and yeah. Who knows from here?
Also, you and I met up with Amy Fallon and some other campaigners during the week in London.
Mm.
And it was a great atmosphere, actually. Everyone in sort of... But it's, you know, you want to be with your friends and to celebrate such a great victory. You got involved in this thing called the Human Chain, didn't you, down the line? There were various, I think, things which caught everyone's eye. Or anyone the mainstream press would allow their eye to be caught, it was caught. You know what I mean? There was. I suppose it's political theatre, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. That was an idea that I tweeted and got, and it took fire. It went viral, you could say. And I was kind of blown away by that. And then Julian's wife retweeted it. I'd sort of taken a Google Earth capture, you know, that's military technology. You know, it's kind of funny to use it against them. And I retweeted that and put, hey, let's do a chain of 1,100 people around Balmarsh Prison to free Assange. And that went viral. And, you know, it ended up, you know, turning into around the parliament because it was a little easier. There were some complications around the prison.
What was the problem with the prison? Is it too big?
Well, it was that there was private ground, so they would have been able to kick us off it. So that was something I wasn't quite aware of. It was a little unclear from the satellite. So once we found that out, it was John Rees that took over and then put it around the parliament, and they did a great job of promoting it. And we did. We got it, ended up as 8 to 10,000 people. What it was a marvelous day. Sun was shining. I just arrived from New Zealand, and it was without much sleep, but it was on a long flight. But it was one of the greatest days of my life. Yeah, it was just a wonderful feeling of solidarity. All these people holding hands. Just as a sign of, yeah, beautiful solidarity.
Fantastic. Freedom. I mean, and also, you see, of course, the idea of the military is that, oh, he's an enemy of this country. Well, in a way, it's a bit like the Palestinian cause. The actual popular feeling in the UK is for the side of right and good, not for what the government is trying to push. There is something bizarre about Balmarsh, and I understand why you focused on that with the original idea.
Yeah,
that somehow Julian is some kind of horrendous risk of some kind. I mean, you know, he's not. He's a journalist, and yet he's put in this maximum security jail with all those restrictions that go with it. So, first of all, what were the restrictions? And secondly, why do you think he was in there?
Yeah, exactly. Well, firstly, I want to say, like, exactly well said. Like, is he an enemy of the United States and democracy, or is he a hero? Like, I think most people who've actually looked into the case recognize that what he did was journalism, telling the truth, freedom of speech, democracy in its highest form. If that's not what the United States stands for, then what do they stand for? To me, he is an American hero. He has talked about, oh, he's Australian, of course, but in terms of the values that the United States professes to be built upon, he is a hero for that. And he's said that he loves the United States Constitution above all. And that he was trying to enforce the First Amendment around the world. So I think he is a hero in that sense. What did he do? Yeah, he revealed the truth. He revealed, so the people had an idea of what their government, which they elect to represent them, was actually doing with their taxes, and if that's, you know, what it's all about, that's what it's all about, isn't it? So, and as far as the restrictions, yeah, they were brutal. Balmarsh We've got our Irish Labour campaigner here. Apparently, Belmarsh was built to house the IRA, and it is the most brutal prison and secure prison in the United Kingdom. And yeah, why the heck was he there? He wasn't even serving a sentence. He's a non-violent prisoner. I mean, that question was answered when the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture visited him with top forensic psychologists, and they determined that he was being tortured, originally in solitary confinement 24 hours of the day. The prisoners, who are a lot of them serial murderers and terrorists, actually protested themselves, writing a letter to the governor of the prison to get him out of solitary confinement.
What were they saying, that this guy isn't a maniac like us? Or what were they saying?
I don't know. I'd love to see.
We only want maniacs in here.
Yeah, that's right. If you're doing something right, if you've got murderers and terrorists sort of feeling sorry for you and taking a stand of solidarity to look after you.
Seriously, that's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's really moving, and that's what it takes, and that's how we got him out in the end. It was solidarity and the movement of the people from the grassroots up that's freed him, and I think it's a great lesson for all time, that anyone says to you, there's nothing you can do. You know, you get that cynicism all the time,
don't
you?
Yeah.
Well, this to me is the perfect example. I mean, there are others in history, but this is going to go down in history as one of those examples of, well, you know what? They wanted this guy bad, and we got him out.
I mean, we were talking to John a few months ago, in a quite it was quite a harrowing interview, because there were suggestions that Julia might die in there.
Oh, for sure. It was a constant anxiety for anyone that was campaigning and was keeping their eyes on it, right? And I've spoken to activists that have felt this relief that, you know, now we don't live day to day with that background radiation, the anxiety that, will, you know, is Julian going to die in this prison, and what will that mean for our democracies? So we've avoided the very worst, and so he is free, and now it's time for him to cover, but he has pled guilty to journalism, and that's a worry.
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, I remember Jen Robertson, his barrister, when he was released, saying, actually, this is a fairly minor court, so the idea that this can be used isn't necessary, it's certainly not cast in stone.
Yep.
But can you just give us your take, Max? I know you were following this really closely. I think there was something in the New York Times at the end of the week he was released, which was talking about how it happened and why. Because the United States, it looked as if there was signals within the United States that they may actually lose the case in the British courts or in the European courts, and that would have set another precedent, which would have been even more embarrassing. So, Tony, what's your take on how it came to Julian's release?
Yeah, that's right. It's a good question. And just first of all, on your point about what Jen Robinson said, and she said some great things about it, and it is true that it's not a tight or a higher court legal precedent. However, just the fact that they have applied it and forced him, rather than backing down and just dropping the charges, it's still a precedent of sorts, you know, and that they've gone after him all this time and forced him to be imprisoned for 14 years in total. It's still a terrifying precedent in that sense. And it won't be solved until they change the law now that they, essentially, it's the Espionage Act. They promised when they wrote it, you know, there were constitutional experts at the time back in 1912 that objected to the way it was written. It was supposed to go after spies, but they were like, hang on, the wording of this means you might be able to go after a publisher or a journalist for revealing state crimes. They were, no, we'll never use it in that fashion, don't worry. Ooh. They kept that promise for 98 years until they prosecuted Julian and with it. So that's the danger, and that's what we can't lose sight of. In fact, this isn't really over until that is burnt, or, you know, that's the way I like to phrase it. We could try to reform it, but we need to look into that. It doesn't allow a public interest defense, which is the only defense you could have as a journalist or a publisher for publishing anything classified, which is something journalists do daily, I understand, you know, so it's... So that's the danger. As far as, like, how did we free him? And it was, I believe it was grassroots up. You know, people say, oh, they'll never, you know, but yeah, they won't unless we make them.
Well, the fact was, wasn't it, that there were lawyers within the US State Department who were saying, hang on, guys, it looks like we might going to be losing this
yeah,
case.
Yeah, that's right. So there was that. It was quite... It did seem that they'd, you know, Craig Murray said it very well, that they had seemed to box themselves into a logical corner they couldn't escape. There was many grounds of the appeal which he should have been allowed to have heard or won on, but the one that they allowed, that they didn't seem to be able to get out of, was that they had clearly said that he, as an Australian, this is the profound hypocrisy of it, was that they wanted to punish him and try him on a US law, even though he's an Australian. However, they weren't prepared to give him the protection of the United States law of the First Amendment. I mean, you know, on one hand giveth, one hand take away. You know, like, what? Like, so, and that's what it was going to hinge on. It did seem that, he wasn't going to be able to use the First Amendment to defend himself because he was an Australian.
So this is basic free speech.
Yeah, it is.
Freedom of speech, all around freedom of speech, yeah.
So it looked like they were going to lose on that. And I spoke to Craig Murray on this the week before the plea and after. And he, because he's very on the inside there, you know, very close to the family.
He was a former diplomat who was giving them advice, wasn't he, about, you know, this might be an opportunity, this might not.
Yeah, and so he was sort of talking to me about the plea deal. I didn't know that it was in the air at the time, but it was. He was asking me my thoughts on it, and I was, which were a few. But I think he made the right choice to get out. But I think that what it came down to, and I asked Craig this, I was like, did he do this? You know, we had a strong feeling that he would win and get this and actually succeed, block the appeal finally. But why did he do this? And I asked him, was it because of the small chance that he lost? And they put him straight on a CIA plane to spend his rest of his life in solitary confinement. Mm. And he said, yes, that's it. It's like, was it a 5% chance? Yes, but would it mean that he would be in the torturous hell of 24 hours solitary? That's what people have to get their heads around. You know, it's a horrific state. And no, it's fate worse than death. And that is why. So it was under duress. That shows to me that it was under duress that he did this. So that's another part of it.
Well, an out-of-court settlement of some sort is always going to be better than just going to court with the possibility that that might be the end and you may be going down and you may not even get these basic First Amendment rights. Well, anyway, Martin, it's been quite important for journalism generally. But don't you think, in a way, the Americans are now going to be looking for the next Julian Assange? There's going to be someone else that they, I mean, the Russians have got Alan Dershowitz, I think is in his name, or Aaron Dershowitz. And this is starting to become, the idea here is that the military on both sides, and all sides, are trying to get people who are saying, blowing the whistle, in jail, so they can't publish.
Well, if you think about it, he has been horrendously publicly punished, and lots of people who are going into journalism as young people will get the message, won't they? They'll realise, well, there's certain things we're not going to do, and that's why they've done it. The Espionage Act, in fact, was used to put...
Daniel Ellsberg?
No, Daniel Ellsberg was never prosecuted in the FBI Act because they couldn't...
They almost did,
but then they realised they couldn't do it. But back in the day, in the First World War, I'm trying to remember the name of the guy. He was the leader of the Socialist Party in the US. The name's on the tip of my tongue, but I can't remember it. But he was put in prison under the Espionage Act for opposing the First World War. Mm. And eventually he was released. And, of course, the Espionage Act in the 1960s, it only used to apply to American citizens in the US, and it was used in a repressive way against the Wobblies and people like that.
Who are the Wobblies?
The Wobblies were the industrial workers of the world, the sort of anarchist trade union, which were quite influential in the US in the early part of the 19th century. So this was all directed at them.
Funded by the communists, were they?
No, they're totally independent of that. Yeah. I'm trying to remember the name of the senator that was sent down, because it'll come to me in a minute, but anyway, people can look this up. I mean, that's what the internet's for. So it was used, and then in the 60s, they then extended the Espionage Act to the whole planet, So you could be charged with espionage against the United States in any country, and any individual can be charged under it, which, if you think about it, is an extraordinary thing for a country to do, to say we can charge anybody from any country with espionage against us. Like, at the end of the day, Assange is an Australian citizen.
Yeah.
How can he be charged with espionage against the United States when he's
in
not even...
Britain. While he's in Britain.
Well, I mean, this is what's wrong with the whole thing. And of course, by pleading guilty in the Marianas, that just keeps that whole thing going. That they can, in theory, arrest anybody anywhere and charge them with espionage against the United States.
Yeah,
but of course, what it does do is the whole world watching this and how hypocritical and rubbish it all is, and it's part of them losing global power. It's another brick falling out of that wall, isn't it? And of course. They find it very difficult to lecture Putin about locking up political prisoners whilst Assange is still in Belmarsh.
Oh, totally.
It's like, shut up, what are you on about?
Undermines their moral authority, doesn't it?
Do you want to say, Matt, give us a couple of ideas of specific leaks that Julian was involved in? I mean, I think everyone knows the Iraq War diaries, which was the killing of the Reuters journalists, the cameramen, where these American guys in a helicopter were saying, hey, he's got a gun. No, it's a camera. Yeah.
Right.
So are there any particular leaks that you think were, struck you as significant?
Yeah, I will. And can I just go on
Mr.
Labour Irish said about scaring young journalists. He's got a real name. Martin, scaring young journalists coming into the field. Now, I was planning a birthday celebration for Julian's 50th, which he was going to spend in solitary confinement back when I was in Auckland, New Zealand. I went along to like a big warehouse to buy a bunch of stuff, got to get some balloons. And at the counter, I said, oh, I bought some 50th balloons. And I was like, these are with helium. These are for Julian Assange, I said. And then there's a young girl at the back, her ears pricked up. She came over and said, are these for Julian Assange? And I said, yeah.
So where were you?
This was in Auckland, New Zealand. Back in New Zealand. And I said, yeah, they are. And how do you know about Julian Assange? You know, she's probably looking about 19 or something. Like, I was like, curious. And she said, well, I was going to study journalism, and then I found out what they've done to Julian Assange and Edward Snowden, and I changed my mind.
Well, actually, Snowden got away, didn't he?
Yeah, well, that's right. He's away, but if he sits back foot,
so
in
she's
the
saying
States,
basically. Well, I suppose, that's the point, isn't it? That you're going to have to get out of New Zealand or Australia or the Empire if you want to be a journalist.
And that says it all to me. I mean, we can't have someone like her. And I remember telling that to Nicky Hargo, who's a great New Zealand investigative journalist who worked with Julian.
Remember him,
And he said, that's terrible. You know, if she was, if she said that, that means she was going to be a good one.
Yeah, she's our future.
Yeah, if she's following Assange and
Snowden. So they've been pressing her buttons, Martin.
So it's already had an impact, which is horrific.
Anyway.
And then back to, your question about the leaks. I mean, gosh, there's so many. I mean, as the lawyers said, I got to monitor one of the trials and heard Julian's lawyers put to the court that these represented the largest revelations of U.S. state criminal behavior in U.S. history. So there was a lot. But, of course, it wasn't only the United States. He revealed corruption around the world, Russia, everywhere. Some of the leaks inspired the Arab Spring, but there was more material on the United States. Some people criticized him for that. But the fact is just that he got more. He wasn't selectively persecuting the U.S. It's just that Chelsea Manning happened to she's the military analyst that leaked to WikiLeaks. That's key to note. He never hacked or stole anything. She leaked it to him willingly, after the New York Times, was said that it was too hot for them, the Washington Post, too hot for us. Julian was willing to do it, and then he got all those papers together, the New York Times, the Guardian, the other papers, El País, Der Spiegel, Le Monde, from around the world, the five biggest papers around the world. And that was another novel thing that Julian was able to do, was to get these big news organizations to work together. But he was kind of the fall guy, willing to, publish it first, and he ended up taking the fall. But for award-winning journalism. Now, what was it? Yeah, as you say, the collateral murder video, a lot of people have seen the Apache helicopter gunning down a bunch of civilians and two Reuters employees. and then the father that came to try to rescue them, and they were firing on unarmed people that were crawling around on the ground, and then someone that came in a a civilian car with a couple of children in the back to rescue them, and they opened fire with these anti-tank Hellfire missiles right onto these civilians. So it's horrific, and you look into the lives of these people, and it's really, there's interviews with them, it's really moving. You know, once you get down to that human level, it's just one grain of sand in a million, you know, different stories that Julian revealed. There were many. The Guantanamo Bay torture, there was also environmental corruption, the diplomatic cables. These are the ones that he was specifically prosecuted for. The one that really stood out to me was there was a diplomatic cable, which revealed an incident where US troops went into a home in Iraq and handcuffed a family. There was two children under the age of five and a grandmother. They were shot execution style on the back of the head. Then a bombing raid was called in to kind of clear the evidence of this war crime. But this diplomatic cable, which spoke about it, was released by WikiLeaks. That got into the hands of the Iraqi government, which is the one that the US installed, like their puppet government. But they were so shocked by this, they were like, listen, we're going to have to start reporting these war crimes. This is, you can even find it, it's actually published by CNN. 2 weeks later, referring directly to WikiLeaks, the Iraqi government, you know, and then 2 weeks later, Obama announces the withdrawal of US troops, citing that negotiation, citing the WikiLeaks cable. So here we have a journalist in jail being prosecuted for publishing evidence of war crimes that ended an illegal invasion that killed millions of people, setting a legal precedent that that's a crime. Like, if that doesn't make your blood boil, and you know, like a sense of injustice, like, you know, we cannot have that happening and pretend that we can ever have a world of peace.
I suppose in a way it's a sort of tug of war, all this, between the idea of the rule of law, that the war crimes actually do mean something, or else it's just the law of the jungle, Matt, isn't it? I mean, isn't that what war means often? I noticed this week, by the way, and I really actually love this Plus 972 magazine, Israeli magazine, which also has a Hebrew language version. And we had their editor on couple of months ago, I think, explaining how every article the Israeli military have to look at and allow or disallow that goes through their editorial board, a panel, before it gets, and you know, he gave an idea of the proportion of the articles. Anyway, this one did get through, I suppose, because they can't deny it. Anyway, the article's headline is "I'm bored, so I shoot." The Israeli army's approval of the free-for-all violence in Gaza. Israeli soldiers describe the near total absence of firing regulations in the Gaza war, with troops shooting as they please, setting homes ablaze and leaving corpses on the streets with their commanders. Position. In early June, Al Jazeera aired a series of disturbing videos revealing what it described as summary executions. Israeli soldiers shooting dead several Palestinians walking near the postal road in the Gaza Strip on three separate occasions. In each case, the Palestinians appeared unarmed, did not pose any imminent threat to the soldiers. Such footage is rare due to the severe constraints faced by journalists in the besieged enclave and constant danger to their lives. In fact, deliberate targeting, folks. Something like 180 journalists killed there, even though it's very difficult to verify all of them, because the Israelis make sure it's very difficult to verify by killing the journalists and anyone that goes in being killed too, to try and find out what's going on in the besieged enclave, the constant danger to their lives. But these executions, which did not appear to have any security rationale, are consistent with the testimonials of six Israeli soldiers who spoke to Plus 972 magazine and Local Call following their release from active duty in Gaza in recent months, collaborating the testimonials of Palestinian eyewitnesses and doctors throughout the war. The soldiers described being authorized to open fire, Martin, on Palestinians at will, including civilians.
Yeah, I read all about that this week. Obviously, I'm following these things quite closely.
So there is no rule of law here, is there? If you can just murder civilians, then that's a war crime. So the war crimes are hardwired into the Israeli officers' corps.
Yeah, I'm just to say to the listeners, I've remembered who the U.S. senator was. Eugene Debs. He was the one who was put in prison, and of course he was a leader of the Socialist Party.
But let's not lose this point.
No. I think this what's happening is clear. That the Russians have been accused of war crimes at Bucha and so on in the Ukraine. To my mind, reading what happened at Bucha, that was actually carried out by the Ukrainian forces. And they do this, you see. NATO intelligence services and special forces carry out false flag attacks where they try and put the blame on
others. But the point here is this tug of war between the law of the jungle and the rule of law.
Well, that's why the Chinese and the Russians are now they're going to be sticklers for UN rules about everything. Because it's the rules-based order is the non-rules-based order. That's why they call it the rules-based order, because it's not based on any legal basis. And, of course, Putin is a lawyer, and they're very well aware of what they've got to do to remain on the right side of international law, which is why, of course, they didn't arrange them for Bucha, because they probably know that they did it. And it was done just at the moment when Boris Johnson turned up in Kyiv to tell them to fight on, even though they got a peace deal on the table. Zelensky had signed up for it. It was mediated by the Israelis and the Turks. It was all agreed what was going to happen. And then the British sabotaged it. And, of course, part of that British sabotage was to have a load of pictures in the media of all these people who've been murdered by the terrible Russian soldiers. Because the Russian soldiers had retreated from Kyiv as part of the agreement. That's why they're gone. That's why they never wanted to take Kyiv in the first place. And part of the agreement they'd made with Zelensky was that we will withdraw. So they withdrew. And then, of course, 3 days later, suddenly we find all these dead bodies around the place. Just absolutely, just stinks, really. And, of course, they did it. Like, they carried out the Maidan massacre as well, because there was a court case in Kyiv in 2017 where the riot police, the Berkut riot police, had been put on trial for shooting the demonstrators. And, of course, they walked because they had a testimony on video from two of the shooters who were actually from Georgia. And they were brought in from Georgia under the command of a US officer called Boyenga, Christopher Boyenga, and they shot both police officers and demonstrators. And it was carried out by NATO. And of course, I talked about this on Russia Today when it happened. It was all over the news in Russia. But of course, people in the West simply do not know that that court case took place or what the implications
of
it were.
So who's going to win this tug of war? This is the question, isn't it? Because surely those who are prepared to tear up the rule books have an advantage, don't they? They can go and find the leader of the people who want to, even if it's to do with the International Criminal Court. These lawyers were being threatened. The judges were being threatened.
Yeah, John Bolton told the International Criminal Court's lawyers, "We know where your kids live." Mm. That's who they are, and that's what they like.
Gracious. But surely, if someone is prepared to do things like that, then they're going to beat the other people. Surely?
No, because look at what's happening in Gaza. They've killed loads and loads of civilians, but the guys are still in the tunnels, and they don't know how to get them out. It's like Stalingrad. So they can kill all the civilians they want. From a military point of view, they're losing.
Yeah, I think the problem is you lose your moral authority eventually. There is a limit, you know. I think US power, I even met General Petraeus, who led the invasion of Iraq. Yeah, this was unbelievable. My friend invites me to a festival of music and philosophy, and I was like, oh, okay, a cheap ticket. I'll have a look at the lineup. The first
is this over
name,
in New Zealand or here? Right?
No, this was here about a month ago.
Right.
And I looked at the lineup. I'll see if I'll check it out if it's interesting. The first name I saw, General Petraeus, former head of the CIA, and the general who invaded in charge of Iraq and
Bilderberg
Afghanistan
as well. Yeah,
I was like, right, I might go. Actually, I might have a question for him or two. And so I did, and I actually got to get backstage because my friend had an artist pass, and I was there. There he was hanging out in this tent. And there I was. And so I got to go up to him and ask him. And my question to him, I had to think about this. I was like, all right, I know. What I'm going to ask him is the United States safer for jailing and prosecuting Assange, for revealing war crimes and what have you? Or does it or is the US power and security really based upon the global idea that they are standing for democracy and the rule of law? And
that's quite a long question. It's not as long as the one Martin asked in Nick Clegg, which went on for about 10 minutes. But anyway,
yeah, but that it got him thinking, and to me that it is their real power is based on the idea.
So what did he say? Did he respond at all? Or
he didn't. What did he say? He didn't directly answer that. He sort of resisted the idea that Julian, all he did was journalism. But I told him, I encouraged him to look closer, because all the experts agree that it was. And in fact, if you look at the guilty plea, that's all he pled to was receiving and publishing.
I know what the listeners are thinking. Hey, maybe it was Matt that did it.
That got
pricks the conscience as one of the top people.
For a minute, we wondered, because he actually looked at my I was wearing a Guantanamo Bay prisoner suit and Free Assange sign for the last 2 years until he was freed. I made that promise. So he looked at my sign before I had this chat to him as he was walking off, and tapped his fist on his heart. And put his fist up. I was like, what the heck is just
happening? Petraeus. Wow.
And my friend who was with me, a journalist, our minds were blowing, and we were starting to envision headlines in the Los Angeles Times, New York Times, like Petraeus, you know, wants to free Assange, you know, and we were going to get a statement from him. Yeah. Why did you do that? Turns out, I've got these dog tags here that this American activist made for the Free Assange Army. Halo Benson made these beautiful dog tags and sent them out to a bunch of activists around the world. That is what he was looking at. I didn't realize, and that's what he was excited. He thought I was a soldier.
You tricked him into thinking you was a soldier. You pricked all his conscience, and then he let Assange go.
Well, it was a good opening, at least. And
this is important, isn't it, to take these hate figures and to actually... Yeah. To engage with them on a human level. Because obviously what they're doing is on a totally inhuman level. The idea is yet they're othering masses and masses of people, whether it's Russia or whether it's Gaza being othered. Like, this is nothing to do with us. These are Untermensch, and we're just going to have to wipe them out. You're not engaging. You're not talking. You're just hating.
Yes, that's well said. To me, you can't fight fire with fire. Yeah. And this has been a real theme of the campaign for me, is that are we going to do what they do back to them? Are we going to label people like Petraeus as simply inhuman war pigs, simply evil? To me, that's no different to the fundamental philosophy they are using to other and to destroy and to tear down. Now, I get why people do that. Don't get me wrong. Like, I totally understand. It is inhumane and horrific, the things they are doing. But if you follow, I mean, I love Marsha Rosenberg's nonviolent communication and other approaches to non-judgment. If you look at what the base intention is, it's usually something universal and fundamental. It's for someone like Petraeus, he believes that the US must be secure and look after the citizens of the US, and that they are the leading light of democracy and all the rest of it. He believes, rightly or wrongly, and of course, you know, that's the case, and that in order to do that, I would certainly argue wrongly, they have to kill a whole bunch of Arabs and steal the oil, and they can lie and cheat and murder as many people as they like to achieve that goal of protecting the safety and security of the United States. But that's not an evil intention. It's just a very, very, I mean, you might say evil, certainly extremely harmful way to achieve that goal, right?
I think this is one of the reasons everyone is concerned about the US the US presidential election is because they have this. All we care about is what is their foreign policy going to be, these guys. I mean, they're not really focused on their domestic people and making life better for Americans. They seem to be now, and you were talking about the legal jurisdiction, the American attempt to be the world's legal jurisdiction. In fact, we were hearing from Michael Hudson last week, Martin, weren't we, about this attempt of the Americans to dominate the international order themselves. So it's not an international order if they're trying to dominate. They're a nation, and they're looking after their national interests. So there's a great big hypocrisy at the heart of all of this. But then there's so many other. I mean, for example, the unified command structure that the United States built up in the noughties. They were thinking about doing it in the 1990s. In the noughties, they got this thing called the Unified Command Structure, where they've got a command, a military command for every part of the world. Mm. So you've got CENTCOM, EUCOM, AFRICOM, and all of these decisions, Martin. I mean, the Americans now seem to think that anybody that causes the Americans any difficulty, any part of the world, their military will deal with them, by hook or by crook.
Well, I think what's happened over the last 5 years in particular is that the US military has been shown to be incompetent and incapable. They basically, they're still fighting World War II with their aircraft carriers. The Russians and the Chinese have got anti-ship missiles, which will sink aircraft carriers in the first half an hour.
Actually, they're using these ATACMS at the moment, which are long-range battlefield missiles to actually hit Russia.
Yes, I know.
Maybe we could. Maybe it's a good time to bring up this attack on Sevastopol and the attack on Kiev this week, because when I first saw that, I thought, we've got a NATO meeting coming up in 2 or 3 days' time, a big NATO meeting. Isn't it convenient that a children's hospital in Kiev has been hit?
Well, I've been reading a lot about that. Larry Johnson's pretty good. He's ex-CIA, and he says most likely, the most straightforward explanation, is because the Ukrainians have got air defence. They shoot down incoming missiles, and some of them get hit, and then of course, they fall on buildings that they're not supposed to fall on. So it's collateral damage kind of thing. But there's also a lot of suspicions that they actually timed, that, you know, they blew their own hospital up. Because I used to be an aid worker in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, and it's now well known that the Bosnians blew up their own bread queue just before a meeting of NATO, so they killed 60 of their own people, so they say, oh no, the terrible Serbs have killed our people,
this isn't the incident this week, is it?
No.
I mean, the chances are, surely, this is a Russian missile that's hit this school, not an American missile.
No. There's people been looking at it, and they say it looks like a Ukrainian air defence missile. But obviously, what we've got with the internet now, we've got a sort of, you know, the knowledge of wisdom of crowds. So everybody's
What you get is each side is a little propaganda machine, starts launching off, oh, it's an American missile.
Well, I mean,
it's a Russian missile. At the end of the day, the real question is it feasible this was done deliberately to set the scene for the NATO?
Yes, it is feasible. That's a perfectly reasonable supposition.
Well, remember when there was one in Poland that Ukraine seemed to fire into Poland. It seemed to be determined.
That's right. And the Poles were very upset
to get boots on the ground, or more boots on the ground.
That's we've got a real nest of conspiracy theorists here.
I saw a Ukrainian battalion social media account even reporting this week that, hey, sorry, but it probably looks like this was one of our own, as you say, like a collateral damage situation.
So what I'll do is I will scry this from Martin, and I will make sure that we put some links up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk so that you good listeners can have a look for yourself. Apparently the missiles are a different shape, and there was film of the missile coming in, so it may be that there can be some basic identification of whether this was a false flag attack. It's a lot more likely to be deliberate, isn't it?
It's perfectly reasonable to suppose that it might be deliberate because of the history of what NATO intelligence services and the Ukrainians have done. The attack on the Crocus Theatre in Moscow suburb, those guys were fleeing towards Ukraine when they were captured. So it's pretty, I mean, I think that, you know, the Russians have pretty much worked out, as far as they're concerned, that was Western intelligence services working with the Ukrainians. And of course, the murder of Yakachenko, who was the prime minister of Donbass Republic, he was murdered by a bomb in a light fitting in a restaurant. And so were Zevi and Motorola, who were paramilitary leaders. They were murdered. And of course, this stuff is all in the news in Russia. But, you know, Russia's quite a sophisticated place. People follow the news closely. They know all about this stuff. But the Western public opinion has basically been fed a diet of drivel about it all for many years.
You see how quickly the White House Press Secretary, Matthew Miller, says this was a Russian attack on a hospital. And there was a White House journalist, bless him, that asked, well, Can you just tell us, how do you verify this information so quickly when in previous cases and other conflicts, such as in Palestine, you take weeks and then don't even give your opinion at all? You defer and you never actually state that this was an Israeli attack on a hospital. You know, how, you know, so there's a definite double standard. And it comes back to this question, Tony, before, about, you know, the rule of law and fighting dirty, the rule of jungle. Sometimes when I talk about Assange to people, because I have conversations all the time going around in the orange suit, which I now have taken off, but it prompts questions. Sometimes people say to me, well, but war crimes happen all the time. You know, I say Julian revealed war crimes. They say, yeah, but that happens all the time. I go, yeah, that's fine, right? We know that. But there's a difference between doing something in the darkness and getting away with it versus jailing and actually torturing, according to the UN, the journalist who reveals it. That is a whole new paradigm that we have not dealt with in the West for a very long time. You probably have to go back centuries, right, to find someone literally being straight up prosecuted or tortured for simply revealing the state's crimes. I mean, I don't know. When was the last time this happened in the United Kingdom?
Well, don't forget, we've had the war in Ireland and all the rest of it. So in actual fact, there's an awful lot of dirty business that which has gone down around here.
Mm.
The point I would make about all of this is, going back to the 1970s, the Gladio infrastructure in Italy, the kidnap of Aldo Moro, the Prime Minister, the bombing of Bologna Railway Station. There's a book called La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, which is written by Posimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court. He's dead now. Basically said, police investigated all of this. We know who did all this. It was NATO intelligence services.
But on the other side, was it Udolf Ulfkotti, the German journalist, who actually wrote a book all about how the intelligence services infiltrate the press,
everything.
We had a clip from Loki last week talking about how one of the chief military correspondents or foreign correspondents on Sky News was a former person who'd been working for NATO. The idea that there's this sort of revolving door in industry we know about, you know, that you've got a powerful lobby like the pharmaceutical lobby. People will go, and now, isn't it Patrick Vallance has just been chosen to be some sort of science minister from the pharmaceutical industry into government, and then even further into government as a minister in the House of Lords. So these revolving doors are quite well known about. So the lobbyist that suddenly becomes a minister, and you think, oh, God, haven't I seen him before somewhere with a different suit on, I think? But yes, but when it comes to the press and the military, people don't necessarily realise that this is going on.
Yeah, Loki is great at revealing those sort of things. If you guys are not following him, he knows his stuff. And it is the type of thing that, you know, before I started really paying attention to the media like I have since campaigning on Assange last 5 years, you know, I would have thought someone telling me that was like, there was some truth to it, but that it sounded a bit like of a conspiracy theory. But it doesn't take long. Once you actually look into it, it's really clear. I mean, there's Operation Mockingbird. I mean, there are former heads of the CIA that have come out. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but have said that, yeah, we've got people all up in the media, you know, and there's been a bunch of former CIA whistleblowers or people just speaking out about it. And it's not really surprising when you think about it. If your concern is to control the narrative, to maintain your hegemony and be able to, you know, maintain your security, aka, you know, do whatever you want, wherever you want, and get away with it, to maintain your global control of the planet, of course you're going to want to go and control the media. It's the smart move if you want to be a good tyranny
what it does is it turns news bulletins into adverts, really, for war and sort of propaganda. So there's someone reading out some kind of auto cue, a bit like Biden before he went off message yesterday. So anyone, any idiot can do that, really. I mean, I think it was the playwright,
karaoke president.
Well, that's right. The playwright Dennis Potter called these people glorified bus conductors. Mm. You know, you just take someone who's not got no real discernment or no ability to penetrate into a story and to uncover it. Just stick an auto cue in front of them, and off they go. So the book is, by the way, if people are interested, and it's a friend of ours, Paul Barbara, that Martin and I work with quite closely. famously in the 9/11 Truth campaign many years ago, who actually got this, managed to get it arranged to get it translated into English, and it's called Prestitutes, Udo Ofcotti, because it was in German originally, Embedded in the Pay of the CIA. And it's, came out in October 2019, but it gives you a really good, I think, brilliant insight into the closeness of the military and the press. And I think that's, in a way, Matt, this is the thing that Julian punched a hole right through.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that was this idea that the military can just tell everybody what they want them to hear and censor what they can't. So, for example, we've just been hearing about the Children's Hospital attack on Kiev, a whole bunch of stuff that hasn't been in the mainstream press. I suppose, ultimately, what everyone wants to know is who's going to be the new Julian Assange. He's obviously off. He's retiring. He's swimming. He's having supper with his kids, etc. Are there enough people around, do you think, to do the job? Because there are people who've been put off, but there's other people who've been inspired by him.
Yeah, that's right. It's a wonderful question. I think we've got an inevitable wave of truth and new information coming. The Assange case is a terrifying, tyrannical threat, but I think we will find ways around it. I think it's just the time for that. The information age is upon us. It is a huge battle, and we have to be mindful. We have to be careful. But I just think there's an inevitable force, and especially the fact that we've managed to free Julian, although he suffered an awful lot and he is now recovering. I think Julian will be back, but we should not rely upon him once he gets well. I think it's inevitable. You can't, you know, Leopard doesn't change his spots. He is coming back. I think the writing's on the wall, but we shouldn't, as you say, rely on him. I think the idea is we should have multiple WikiLeaks. And I love the way social media can play a part in this. I thought TikTok was really probably a lot of people listening still think it is like just a place for cat videos and silly dance crazes. But what I was being surprised to find was that when I started putting content on there about Assange and other things, I got much more interaction there than on other platforms like Twitter.
Yeah, this is the algorithms, isn't it?
And that's right. And I, you know, I put a video on there, and sometimes I got 500,000 views on a couple of them, whereas on Instagram or Twitter, you know, maybe a couple of thousand. And I was like, what's going on here? Why is the US now trying to censor TikTok? Is this related? Because they've got less control of it. I mean, Zuckerberg and less so Musk, but even Musk, you know, they are embedded into that
system. Every bit as much Musk, actually.
Yeah, when it comes down to it, he is. I mean,
he's maybe just a bit better at PR than Zuckerberg is.
Yeah, he's got a less of a tight control than Zuckerberg, I'd say, but there's still, when it comes down to it, there's still clearly filtering things.
Well, you mentioned Craig Murray. He's done quite a lot of work on this whole idea of shadow banning. So if someone starts to say things that aren't liked, whether it's Google, on YouTube platforms, what happens is you just can't find it on the search, even if you're searching for it.
Right.
The other thing is it doesn't pop up on your feed. It's gone. So you get basically, it's a blacklisting system. It might be various shades of grey, but Craig is the sort of person who, if he's got 20,000 followers, this might pop up on two of them on their feed, and the rest of them just won't see it even.
Yeah, there's the great thing, the Twitter files. So to his credit, Musk did release the Twitter files to a couple of good journalists, Matt Taibbi, and there was another fella. They came and did a talk here last year with Russell Brand hosted. It was great. And went along to that, and it was great. If you look into the Twitter files, they really did reveal that the CIA was having weekly sit-downs with the leaders of Facebook, Twitter, and NBC and CNN and Fox, I believe, weekly briefings on what sort of content they were going to ask them to censor and control. There was also directly employees of the CIA and NSA working in these companies like Twitter. Matt Taibbi said they had a raft of controls and ways that they could reduce the visibility of certain content. And you know, so that it wasn't seen. And so that is a real thing. There is evidence for it, and it's now out there. So it's, the truth is out there if you're just willing to look for it. And, but I think that it's a wonderful paradigm. And if we can just get a system that, is free from the censorship, wow, what an amazing tool we have to, to share truthful information. And of course, there's going to be conspiracy theories and misinformation amongst it. But watch out for anyone saying that that's what we need to police, because that's going to be inevitable. But the truth will out, I think, if we give
Telegram
the freedom.
Keir Starmer was one of those people who said, oh, Telegram, this is a terrible thing. There's all sorts of conspiracy theories being spread on this thing called Telegram.
Yep.
So there are various platforms. Obviously, TikTok is one. But it's, in a way, it's funny, isn't it? The internet has sort of gone up and down. The internet started in, well, came into most people's minds around about in the 1990s, where you could first get yourself a cheap dial-up internet account and put a website up there. And actually, in those days, I think, you know, if you did a search, you would find what you were looking for. As sites suddenly become, like one of mine on the Bilderbergers, started to become overwhelmed by lots of, as the Bilderberg meeting came along during the year, you'd find, I mean, I would actually got a phone call one year from the service provider saying, we've had to take your website down, you're under attack. And I said, well, actually, no, I'm not under attack. It's just that there's lots of people finding out about this for the first time. You know, tens of thousands of people around the world are looking at, what is this Bilderberg thing? Because I had some memos from them and the press releases, which they say at the top, not for publication. I published them online. And so, so what you've got is, as it goes up and down, because the internet, I remember reading this a long time ago, Matt, and maybe you can corroborate. I don't know if it's, you know, your view of how it all started, but the idea is that the internet started as a kind of military communications network for nuclear war, so that it wasn't, there were no central nodes, that the information could flow. So and what happens with censorship online is that the internet detects censorship as damage and routes around it in some way. So, you know, so here's some part of the internet is stopping this information getting through. So the network detects this as damage in the, you know, nuclear bomb has hit this part of the network, so we're going to go round it, round the side. I just rather like that idea, but I think that's why these big social media companies came along, to try and scoop up everybody's individual content, make them think, oh, this is the place, just put it on here and everyone will see it. And now what people are realizing is these algorithms are stopping people actually, what they've tried to do is sort of privatize the internet with things like Facebook and Twitter. And the great thing about TikTok is it's shown you, no, this is not actually doing what you thought it was doing. So I guess the only way to do it is kind of switch the internet off, and then maybe no one will be able to share. There will be no way to get around the censorship then.
Yeah, it's just, we've got to be mindful that all these platforms, even, you know, trying to sing the praises of TikTok, it's just a lesser of evils. Yeah. We do need a platform that is safe against censorship. You know, the time for it has come. People have to realize that, you know, if you think about it, the more we conduct our lives and speak in these spaces, when you talk about complete surveillance and the power to censor your voice, you know, this is an unprecedented time in history. So it's not just censoring what you're hearing, but what you're saying. This is really important. The more we speak online, we cannot allow ourselves to be censored by sort of unaccountable powers in the dark. So, you know, I'd love to hear people's ideas. I know there's something called Panquake and others, but or platforms, I don't know, like Rumble. I'm really interested to explore now what is possible in that space. But we do need a movement to those type of platforms that are free from censorship and that are also offering privacy, you know, control over privacy as well.
Well, the thing is, the other side likes to pretend to do that too. So it will pretend to do, hey, here's a great new platform, everyone. You can come on here. And actually, it's the dark side behind it. I mean, if just one example, Brighteon. So one of my correspondents said, oh, you should get onto Brighteon, Tony. It took me like 3 days to actually get an account registered. Now, most people won't bother with that. What it was doing was saying, oh, we'll email you a thing. You've got to click on your email to verify it. But no email arrived. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, the verification email times out after 10 minutes or something. So actually, it's impossible to register. So I actually took the trouble to get hold of their their, because I mean, a lot of the content that they're putting on there is brilliant. It's really, you know, it's obviously an alternative to YouTube of some sort. And so eventually they said, oh, it's okay. Yes, we've had this problem before. Yeah. Yeah. So to have a new system for registering new people, because I am like the one in a thousand people who will bother to actually find a link to get to the support people to tell them, look, it's impossible to register on your platform. So the what you're dealing with here is a very sophisticated, I mean, I'd say that's some sort of NSA operation or something similar, maybe, you know, another intelligence service, maybe a private business that is blacklisting Brighteons and saying, look, these guys, we don't really want anyone registering on here. Say, for example, with a forum, you know, an internet discussion forum, to try and stop people registering on there, to hack it, or to make it impossible to register new people. Because I ran this thing, the UK 9/11 Truth Forum, from about 2003 to about the mid, well, I suppose it was about 2013 or something, for nearly 10 years. And we had a fantastic discussion on there, which was very, very, all newcomers immediately got access to it. And then if they started messing around, I could just delete them, get rid of them. But it created a great space. And that's the sort of thing I think that these new companies like Facebook have tried to sort of mimic that idea. Anyone can be here. But then they, as soon as the truth starts getting through, they kind of ramp it down. I think we also should talk a bit about the general election. I mean, we're going to talk a bit more about Ukraine, I think, in part two.
One last thing.
Yeah, go on. Sure. Yeah,
it's not just that we need social media networks where it's not censored and where it's private. We also need devices that offer the same, because what I've discovered. Oh yeah, you've got one. What have you got there?
Android, I'm afraid.
No, okay, fail. But I'm rocking around with an iPhone, so okay, I'm the same. But what I've discovered is that they've all got back doors that are built in specifically for the NSA and CIA. What I've been shocked to learn is that even I kind of thought companies like Windows come along and then the NSA and CIA go, oh, they're doing well. We will find a way to get a backdoor in there and da da da. No, it's from the start. It turns out Bill Gates' Microsoft's main financial investor was the CIA to begin with. So it's all from the beginning. It's got to give them credit. It's quite smart. But we have to be smart and be aware, so that we really do. I think it's got to that point. I mean, when they're in the middle of conducting an act of genocide and they've become torturing journalists, I think complacency needs to really go out the window, and we actually need to be smart and get organized and cram up with other systems. So we need devices that do not have backdoors. And if you've got an Android or an Apple phone, they absolutely have a backdoor that no matter if you use Signal, which is supposedly a good encrypted app, if they want to, they can still get in through the baseline of your operating systems on Android and Apple. So, also love to hear any listeners that have suggestions. But that
brilliant.
We need
got actually a page on thisweek.org.uk, which is called Diamonds in the Cesspool. And it's about these sort of platforms that have popped up and websites that have popped up to try and tell the truth. And so what we'll do, Matt, is if listeners want to suggest ones, hopefully that aren't fronts for the NSA pretending to be cool, so we will put them up on there. So that's for all sorts of, I suppose that's for social media. I use vk.com as well, which there's been attempts to try and stop me using that. It's quite obvious, and I just had to reinstall it, and it started working fine. But I'll put those up on the thisweek.org.uk if you go to, I think it's just called Diamonds in the Cesspool, which is an expression I got from Glenn over at Exodus, Glenn Jenkins. When he was dealing with, I think it was the local council on musicians and people like that, when they were doing their free parties. So that's, I think, really useful to do that. And so, folks, if you can just, if you've got platforms you think are really good ones, and I think, actually, was it Duncan Campbell I interviewed a few weeks ago? He was suggesting one on the long interview I did with him. So I'll dig that out and put that on there too. Because you're absolutely right. We need to fight, rather than curse the darkness, we need to shine the light. Yeah. Let's go this way, guys. Look, there's a small bunch of people over there doing something really good. Let's big them up rather than curse the obvious.
Totally, yeah. You can't. You've got to be the alternative, I think, just, more than just, try to.
It's funny you mentioned this
this
week because my phone. This is actually a Huawei phone,
right?
And quite an old one. And it works okay. Yeah. Only thing is, last week, Lee, who's one of the people over at Kumba, I was chatting with him, he said, oh, just message me, you know, just to make sure we had each other's numbers. Anyway, I messaged him something else because it had occurred to me I wanted to tell him something else. And it came up, the first time I've ever seen this, on my SMSs on this phone, it said fail. So it wouldn't send him an SMS. It sent him one earlier in the day. Later in the day, it just wouldn't send him anything. And so when I next saw him a few days later, I said, oh, I showed him the phone. He said, oh, yeah, a few people have said that to me, that they can't send SMSs. And I send a normal SMS message because he's got an old kind of, you know, one of these very basic old school cheap phones. For obvious reasons, he doesn't want a smartphone. And then from that moment onwards, right, this phone has stopped working. So if I phone somebody, the phone call carries on, and I can't turn the phone call off. And the only way to stop the phone call is to reset the entire phone. And that's just it. So there's obviously these are all nudging us towards, oh, don't use this phone. Go and get a new one. You know, this phone is no good anymore, Tony. You need to get rid of it. You need to buy a new phone. And that's a constant thing. It's almost like in the old days they used to try and get, well, they probably still do to a certain extent, harass phone numbers. So you think, oh, I'm going to change my phone number. Then, of course, all your contacts, people that are trying to contact you, can't get hold of you anymore. And so there's a lot of this sort of tech bullying going on. Anything more to say in response to that, Martin or Matt?
Well, I think the other thing they've got is they've got armies of trolls. You know, the Brigade 77, British Army unit, I suppose they've got 1,000 members. They're all officers, so they're all on at minimum 30, 40 grand. And and it's named after Brigade 77, which is the Chindits, who were the stay-behind teams in Burma during the Second World War.
Nothing to do with the London bombings, then?
No, but of course, Ord Wingate, who set up the Chindits, also helped to set up the Haganah and the Irgun in Israel, because he was very pro-Israeli. So he helped the Israeli paramilitaries, who were basically terrorists. I mean, they bombed the King David Hotel, they killed Folk Bernadotte, they killed Lord Moyne, and loads of innocent civilians were blown up and shot by them. These are the people who inherited the State of Israel. That's how the State of Israel was created. And, of course, they weren't punished. They were rewarded. And when they point the finger at Hamas and just say, well, look, they're doing exactly the same as you did. They copied you. Yeah? You did that, they're doing that. But they expect that they are going to have a state at the end of it just like you got one. And they're going to get it exactly the same way.
Now, double standard.
Well, yes, but of course,
rules-based order when we want to apply the rules.
Anyway, but you've got Brigade 77, but also, of course, the Israeli, what is it, 800 unit. So they've got people.
Unit 8200.
Yeah, they've got students are paid to sit there and enter into forums. Right.
You also get major news stories being generated by these trolls, and it's people saying, oh, I'm being harassed. Yeah, but who are you actually being harassed by? Human beings or by someone sitting in a psychological warfare office somewhere who's actually doing this and pretending to be an ordinary, but you know, so there's a lot of, I think, kind of almost like ghosting these various accounts. It's not actually ordinary people. It's they're doing it is to try and turn you into a victim. You know, this whole thing of turning people into victims now. I mean, the Israelis have been doing it for decades, but we are the victim. I'm a victim. Maybe not. Maybe you're not. Maybe you're just part of some sort of game that's being played online, a sort of journalistic sting.
Obsessed with the idea of controlling the narrative, and then it leads to ludicrous situations like the so-called Ghost of Kiev aeroplane. During the beginning of the crisis, this phase of the crisis, there was supposedly this aeroplane that was going out and shooting down Russian planes every day. Some great hero was flying it. And all over the media has been pushed. And then, of course, somebody noticed this is actually a video game.
This is why the military so love to control the press, because they insert these stories in, as Annie Mashong brilliantly talked about.
The thing about this is, though, is that they're so obsessed with controlling the narrative that they've forgotten, but the Russian army doesn't bother to control the narrative. They just try and control the battlefield, the narrative secondary. And they convince themselves that if they can convince enough people, I mean, there's a load of nonsense come out this week about the Russians have had over half a million casualties. Most evidence suggests that they have nothing like that level of casualties.
How many then?
Well, the best estimates that I've seen, and this comes from McGregor and Ritter, who were ex-US military.
Pro-Russian, though.
Pro-Russian, but on the other hand, professionals. Yeah, they know how to assess these things.
Well, Scott Ritter said the whole war was going to be over in 2 weeks.
Well, that's because...
That's not very professional.
Well, no, because that's not... Okay, well, people get things wrong as well. You know, you've got...
Even you and I get things wrong.
Well, indeed. I mean, what we thought at one stage... I mean, when it started, I thought, well, we're going to have sort of World War II-style envelopments here. But clearly not. The technology's changed. I've just been reading about this earlier. The Ukrainian... The Americans are going to supply all this AI first-person view... drones, and of course these drones do make it very difficult to manoeuvre because you can be seen immediately. And the AI will know exactly. So they'll know exactly what.
Can you explain that, please?
Well, because the first person drones, first person view drones, FPV drones, they are turning the battlefield into a kind of completely surveyed space. So, you know, your tank can be knocked out by one of these things, and one of these things doesn't cost very much. So it's completely
changed. When you say first-person view, what does that mean?
Well, it means somebody sitting there on it with a console, and they can see what they're doing. Okay. But, of course, what they're doing now is they're developing AI swarms, which don't even need a person to sit there reusing
them. That's right. Yeah, they've got autonomous weapons, drones now. I mean, we really are in Terminator 2 now. There's this terrifying protocol that was designed... And by Israel for use in Palestine and Gaza.
Daddy's Home, it was called.
Yeah, Daddy's Home.
And that's right. So you wait until the guy comes back into his family, he's there, and then you drop the bomb on to kill as many people as possible.
They're trailing the alleged combatants or whoever their target is all the way home. The drone's flying. You know, they've got them in his sights. They wait till he gets home to be with his family to take out the family home while they're at dinner, and they wait till a specific dinner time.
Yeah.
To do it, I mean, if you want to talk about evil, how, you know, that you know, you could say it's just like so horrific. It is terrorism that's designed to intimidate, and that's why this type of technology
and demoralize as well.
Demoralize, exactly. Yeah. And this is another part of the arsenal of the security forces or the tyrannical forces, depending on your point of view, that exists now that really makes it, I think, incumbent on us all to really look at how we can fight back or you know, create systems that work for us to protect us, because, you know, you add it all together, what there is unprecedented, you know, total global surveillance. They have microphones in our pockets. I mean, they literally do. It sounds ridiculous. They do. They've got AI monitoring all that information. I came to this conclusion, then I read, of course, Julian Assange came to the same one 10 years ago, ahead of the curve he is, saying that it doesn't really matter that they can surveil us all because it's too much information and they're not that bright. They can't do enough with it. But he said, look out, it will be a problem when they've got artificial intelligence, which can actually try to make some order out of these, you know, millions of bits of information.
In the past, they collected information. The Stasi used to have, card index files, you know. So you have to literally listen to the phone call and transcribe it.
Whereas now they've got a warehouse full of even communications going back decades, and now they can actually sort through it and make sense of it. To me, that's a problem that they could identify certain patterns. They could figure out certain social and political movements
What with these massive profiled databases of the entire population, they can literally press a button. I mean, funnily enough, the IBM Hollerith system used to be used by the Nazis for this. So they would use these punch card system back in the Second World War, which they were paying IBM to use these machines, to say, for example, you know, we want all the Jews in Dresden. And they press a button on the machine, the cards would go tick, tick, tick. After a few minutes, you'd have a whole bunch of addresses of cards of specific individuals for the SS to go out and arrest. Now, if you transpose that onto the modern day profile databases of the entire population with the police, these little police vans I've seen Big Brother Watch talking about this week, out in the street doing facial recognition on everybody.
Right.
This is the problem. That surveillance is incredibly pernicious. And in fact, what they could do, they could say, for example, decide that every Christian in a city was going to be arrested or because they were under suspicion for some reason. And they wouldn't have to necessarily tell people why they're being arrested. They would just be, they could just be incarcerated. And this is why it seems to me they're trying to move towards this kind of wartime position, because that would give the authorities an excuse to just simply arrest and clamp down on everyone and get rid of civil civil liberties.
That's right. And people will say, well, we need these security services to look after us. We need this global surveillance to look out for terrorists. But how many terrorists have they actually caught? I've heard potentially none, actually.
Well, the other thing
is they have tracked down journalists and killed them. It's what you call a turnkey tyranny, this system. And you might go, well, it's fine to give them this power because we trust the United States. I mean, at this point, I don't know why you would, but some people still do.
Those Nazis that went over there after the war.
Yeah. The problem is, there's as I say, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so there is no one, no state that should be entrusted with this type of power. Total mass surveillance, robot dogs with guns. This is all the makings of a tyranny, you know, turnkey tyranny. So we have to remove that ability, in whatever ways we can. And I think there is hope. I don't want to, you know, just pick a dark.
Don't you ever think maybe it'd be better to go back to New Zealand and chill out?
Me worry?
They can observe you in New Zealand. There's no way.
But it's a different kind of world.
Why I started to love the bomb, isn't it? But, it is tempting to drop out and tune in, but to me that doesn't actually lead to you. It's procrastinating. Yeah. It doesn't lead to you feeling safer.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that.
Yeah,
the Americans. This is Declassified UK, one of our favourite sites. Yesterday revealed America's secret special forces flights to Israel from a UK base on Cyprus. The US military has been flying covert planes to Israel from RAF Akrotiri since the bombing of Gaza began. Declassified has discovered. So they've done a special report on this thing yesterday. Unmarked planes are used by US forces to fly from Cyprus to Israel. As recently at the end of June, the aircraft are believed to be used by secretive 427th Special Operations Squadron and the CIA. They also find 26 huge US military transport planes have landed at UK base on Cyprus, believed to be carrying weapons for the Israelis. Revelations could further implicate British ministers in war crimes. The US Air Force has been sending unmarked planes from Britain's base on Cyprus to Israel since it began bombing Gaza, it can be revealed. The planes are all C-2, for all you nerdy plane spotters out there, C-295 and CN-235 aircraft, which are believed to be used by American Special Forces. They found 18 of these aircraft had gone from the sprawling British airbase on Cyprus, RAF Akrotiri, to Israel's coastal city of Tel Aviv. Martin, this is we know all about what's going on, or at least hopefully most people do, about the drones and Daddy's Home and all this sort of thing. The mass murder the figures we'll be talking about in a minute, because although we know nearly 40,000 civilians, the Lancet this week has talked about 180,000 civilians possibly being killed by the Israelis. So, but this is our good old RAF. Remember the Battle of Britain and all that, fighting the Luftwaffe. Now it seems that we are the Luftwaffe. We are the Nazis. We have decided we can do anything we want to anybody. And we're helping the Israelis in these war crimes. So these specific individuals involved in these flights and these ministers authorising it, they are potentially war criminals too.
Well, that's
right. With our money.
That's right. And, of course, they have been given legal advice which said, yes, you are potentially war criminals, but they won't bring the legal advice out. Sadiq Khan said this. If they won't tell us what the legal advice is, we know what it is. They know that they're potentially being war criminals. The base at Akrotiri, of course... we fought a guerrilla war against Deoka in the 1950s to kick the British out of Cyprus. And then, of course, in 1956, it was used as the base for the Suez trickery, where the Israelis attacked the Egyptians, then the British and the French went in supposedly to separate the two sides, but it was all a stitch-up. And, of course, the Cypriots don't want that base there. They've never wanted it there. in order for them to get independence, they had to agree to have the base, because that allowed Britain to project and the Americans to project into the Middle East from there. And of course, they used an Akrotiri to fly to bomb Yemen. We're at war with Yemen, which I find is absolutely disgusting. I mean, that was not discussed at all, was it? We were promised that if we were going to go to war, we would have a parliamentary discussion.
Now, Crispin Blunt, signed off. Crispin Blunt, no MP, thoughts. Tory MP, no longer. He was kicked out of the Tory party. He wasn't allowed to stand. He was the first MP, and this was around about middle of October, to say, well, we better be careful about supporting all this sort of thing, because it means that British ministers, the Prime Minister, etc., could be taken to The Hague for war crimes or the International Court of Justice. Less than a week later, he was arrested and accused of being both a child molester and a rapist. Now, I don't know what's happened with those cars. I've not heard any more about all of this, but it seems pretty obvious to me that the criminal justice system is totally and utterly corrupt in this country, and it's being used basically to smash over the head innocent people, not just over in Gaza, but here too, and an MP here who was standing up for human rights.
Well, it
destroys his career as well, by the way.
Well, it's gangsterism, isn't it? That's what we're up against. I mean, Richard Cotterill used to be a Tory MP, MEP for this area, and he lives in Italy, and he wrote a book about Gladio, sort of Gladio, the NATO fascist mafia dagger at the heart of Europe. So in actual fact, the NATO intelligence services are in bed with the fascists, so they're directly directing them, and they're also in bed with the mafia. Like Meyer Lansky worked very closely with the FBI in the 1950s in the US. And of course, the top gangsters in the world are mostly Israeli nationals of one kind or another, both Russian and American. So that's what we're up against. And of course, they control the international drugs trade. That's why they keep it illegal, so they can keep control of it. The dogs in the street know this. I was in Colombia in 2005 in a trade union delegation. Dogs in the street know that the CIA runs the drugs trade, and everybody knows it. But of course, you know, liberal public opinion doesn't know it, because they live in a bubble. Mm. It's a sort of controlled, you know, it's a controlled environment. You know, my parents, who are now nearly in their 90s, they watch BBC News every day religiously, and it gives them a very distorted view of the world.
Of course. But I think what's special about this moment is that they're losing control of the narrative, largely because of social media. Even though they're able to limit and restrict information, they're not able to do it sufficiently. And if you look at polling, like even in the US and the UK, where they're controlling the narrative the most through the media and social media, they're just not succeeding on social media enough. And over 50% in both countries believe that Palestine, should be free from this. And so that's really significant, and I think it is terrifying.
Most of our history, we have been dictated to by whether it's a monarch, a military, Cromwell military dictatorship. You know, these various, you know, the elite of basically, it may be just for a couple of decades after World War II, we had a bit of democracy. But Martin is always saying, well, here, you know, it's never really, well, there's never really been, the people have never really been allowed to rule. So it's kind of reverting back to type, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. They're trying to recontrol it, put it back in the box. I don't think they will ultimately succeed. I think it is the battle of the moment for the information, controlling information. I think that's why they're becoming more tenacious. That's why we have something like going after an Assange who really did just fundamentally do journalism. But he just did it in a profoundly more efficient way using the information age's technology. He didn't hack. He didn't do anything actually illegal. But he did it so well. He did his job so well, making use of the internet to receive and share and publish, that they are terrified because, you know, as Martin puts, it's like they've been able to have the pretense of a democracy, technically be one, but control the narrative so much that we don't effectively vote them in and out, or because we don't know what they're really doing. And Julian, as you said earlier, beautifully punched a hole in that. They got terrified. They went after him. And we're talking about, really, I think, going back to the dark ages in terms of locking dissidents up just for telling the truth, straight and literally for that, not sort of pinning him on something else.
But also, they assassinate people. They blow things up.
But that's old
people
school.
But I mean, they've got that as well.
They've got that, yeah. And that, but I, so I always point out to people that, like, some people say to me, oh, yeah, they're lucky. Julian Assange was lucky he wasn't in Russia. They would have just put a bullet in its head. I'm like, no, you don't get it. Like, this is far more terrifying to me than that, because they're maintaining the pretense that this is just, that this is a legal process, wherein, in fact, you know, the UN rapporteurs and redeemed that this was arbitrary detention and torture. And if you think about it, would you rather have a bullet in the back of your head or spend the rest of your days locked in one room by yourself, totally excommunicado? That's what he was facing in the US. He was literally almost in that condition in Belmarsh, 23 hours solitary. I mean, that's, you know, so my heart went out to him every day. It made me feel so anxious, just like the guy is just slipping away. Is beautiful. He's got a beautiful mind. And he said to his someone, his friend that came out, is that he felt his mind was being burgled. You know, when you're cut off like that, is another horrific letter I've read by someone in solitary confinement 24 hours of the day, a CIA whistleblower, Joshua Schult. He basically is begging to meet a cockroach so he can at least pretend to have a conversation with it. Begging to be sent to Auschwitz, and said he would go to the gas knob and at least he could guzzle that down with relish and end this horrific, you know, isolation. So it's terrifying. That's what we're going to get out of the Espionage Act. If we don't burn it, we've at least got to take out the solitary confinement and put a public interest defense in there. The Espionage Act is the greatest legal weapon at the moment. To me, it's the, you know, you line up all of these elements in terms of global surveillance, robot dogs with guns, but
we're laughing yeah. here, folks. And do you know what? Yeah. That's good.
It's nervous
because you have to poke the fun at this stuff. It really is. It's like
the only way to deal with it.
You're supposed to vote for this dystopian nightmare moron.
Yeah. Oh my gosh!
No, we're not voting for you. As you can see, I'm trying to drag things back to the general election.
Yeah, well, we should. I do want to do that. But that's the final thing. The cherry on the top, the most dangerous heart of it all, is once they jail anybody literally for revealing their war crimes, their torture, that is when all those other elements, that's the turnkey tyranny. Jailing and torturing and prosecuting Assange was turning the key, in my view. So while he's out, and while it's not a firm legal precedent, it still is a precedent in terms of the action of doing it, and the fact that you've used it. It's, we're not safe until we burn the Espionage Act.
One of the nice things about Julian is that what's happened is they have revealed what they're most afraid of.
Everyone should just
copy Julian, and that really will upset the evil doers. Look, coming back to the general election, but not so far in that direction. Another story from Declassified UK: the Israel lobby funded half of Keir Starmer's cabinet. Labour's top team has accepted hundreds of thousands of pounds from the Israeli funding lobby. Pro-Israel lobbyists have donated 13 out of Labour's 25 cabinet members since they were first elected to Parliament. Declassified can reveal the list of recipients includes Prime Minister Keir Starmer, his deputy Angela Rayner, Chancellor Rachel Reeves, Foreign Secretary David Lammy, Home Secretary Yvette Cooper, Jonathan Reynolds, who will oversee arms exports to Israel at UK as UK Trade Secretary, is another beneficiary alongside Labour's election mastermind Pat McFadden. His responsibilities now include national security. Ha, that's handy. Now, some of the donations were provided by Labour Friends of Israel, LFI. A lobby group which takes MPs on fact-finding missions to the region. Reeves, McFadden, Reynolds and Technology Secretary Peter Kyle were listed recently as vice chairs of the Labour Friends of Israel. In fact, they've done a nice little graphic here on Declassified UK. Martin, I'm just looking through this. I think I'm right in saying there's actually more people who've been directly part of the Israel lobby in this cabinet than there were in the previous Tory cabinet.
Yeah, well, they've been infiltrating for a very long time. We know the Al Jazeera.
I'll put a link up to this on our show page, by the way, folks. If you want to see these mugshots of these criminals helping, well, they are war criminals. Anyone that's taking money from the Israelis right now are war criminals.
I'll say it. I'll be called a pedophile next week. But Keir Starmer is a war criminal. Yeah.
Well, why specifically?
Why is he? Okay, specifically because he is a human rights lawyer, and so he has no excuse. He cannot plead ignorance. But back in October, he was asked by an interviewer, bless him, who actually did some probing work, to ask him this question. does Israel have the right to cut off food and water to the entire population of Gaza? Keir Starmer, a human rights lawyer, said, yes, I believe they have that right. That is egregious. He cannot plead ignorance. He did not simply say that. He was lying through his teeth. And that is the crime of crimes. Are you kidding? To cut off food and water to an entire population of over a million people that was 50% children. Like, that is inciting genocide. That is literally an act, you know, that is illegal under international law to incite genocide. You know, you have a legal obligation, in fact, to prevent, let alone to you know, fan the flames and incite it. So he is a war criminal, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. He's terrifying to me. He's one of the chief architects going after Assange as the head of the CPS. He was secretly flying to Washington. That's another reason I find him terrifying, while pretending that Julian was hiding only from some spurious alleged allegations in Sweden. He was that was the pretense, and he was literally, it's been discovered again by, bless them, Declassified UK. They revealed these secret flight logs, him going in these meetings. They found records that they were the records were destroyed in the United Kingdom but preserved in the US, that Starmer, as head of the CPS, was meeting with the CIA and the Department of Justice multiple times. I think it was four trips to discuss getting Assange extradited there. So you see how duplicitous he is, how embedded in this tyrannical security state he is. I understand his wife may be a Zionist herself, and I think her husband, her brother, is in the IDF. And as you point out, yeah, more MPs funded by Israel Friends than in the Tory cabinet. I say Labour is more Tory than Tory, and at least in terms of foreign policy. And, you know, by that I mean killing people for oil and gas. Now, I'm terrified of this.
Martin, you're a member of the Labour Party. Well, you actually voted for Keir Starmer to be their leader.
This is we got it. It's like being in the Polish United Workers Party in 1980 when Solidarność was, they had 10 million members at the end of August 1980, and 1 million of those members were simultaneously members of the Polish United Workers Party. That's how change comes about. Yeah, you don't just walk away. And the Labour Party in New Zealand, they had the Rogenomics in the 1980s, the Labour Party changed the electoral system and smashed all of that. And it didn't work entirely. Still, the economy was neoliberalised and all the rest of it. But nevertheless, the Labour Party managed to cleanse itself of that stain. Yeah, and Roger Douglas himself didn't get elected.
I look forward to them cleansing that stain and arresting Keir Starmer in the years to come,
Corbyn has stood as an independent because he had to.
Yeah,
but he wasn't going to leave the Labour Party. Why should I leave? They're the cuckoos.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's why I stayed in it. But I mean, the point about Al Jazeera showed that the shy Moffat, who was a Mossad guy, was saying, "Well, we've got £1 million to spend on."
He was the political attaché at the Israeli embassy, Shai Mossad. Massot, M-A-S-O-T.
Yes,
Massot.
I know, but he was basically a Mossad guy. This political attaché is camouflage.
What's that, Matt? Oh,
so, but did you really? What did he mean? What did Tony mean when he said you voted for Starmer? You didn't prefer him over Corbyn, surely?
Corbyn had stood down, and so it's Rebecca Long Bailey versus Starmer. Now, Rebecca Long Bailey, I like her, but she just didn't. You know, we had to take a punt on a shift. And of course, Starmer said at the time, "If you vote for me, I will govern from the centre."
You trusted
and of course,
him.
Yeah, but I know. But we know now. Because I voted for him, I don't feel any desire to support him whatsoever now. Because, you know, we gave you your chance, mate. We gave you your chance and you blew it.
I totally understand you wanting Labour to beat the Conservatives. A lot of people felt that way. We've had the Tories so long. Personally, however, I did not feel that way. I mean, I didn't have to live here through all of that, so it's a little easier for me to come over here and have my ideas. But Although Labour, I will give them, I think they have slightly, it's hard to tell, but slightly more friendly policies to the, to Britain in terms of like, but it's really hard to tell at this point the difference. I think they are still very Tory, well, no, even on domestic policy. But what terrifies me is the international, the foreign policy.
Yeah, but he's going to have this an albatross
round
his neck.
More vicious. I think he's more
he's going to have this an albatross round his neck. It took a while for Tony Blair to show his true colours.
Mm.
Yeah. We've had to put up with it because he was after years of the destruction of the mining industry, all the things that you've got to be realistic about what you can and can't do in the short.
Okay, folks, let's
getting away with a genocide at the minute.
Well, the thing is, he's going to walk straight into. We've got a demonstration not tomorrow because it's Gay Pride tomorrow, but next Saturday there'll be a demonstration in Bristol. There'll be another one in London. Mm. We are not letting up on this.
No, and if you can, right.
See what's going to happen now? The Israelis are going to go to war in Lebanon. That will draw the Americans in.
Maybe.
And then the Nasrallah has said, if the Akrotiri base is used to attack us, we will attack that base. Yeah.
Mm.
And we've got the missiles. Well, we've got the missiles to hit it.
Nasrallah has also said. Nasrallah has also said, if they stop killing people in Gaza, if there's a ceasefire there, we will just. Automatically, no negotiation, we will stop all of our aggression towards the Israelis.
But the Smotrich and the right wing in Israel do not want to negotiate.
Can we just get back to the new cabinet? We've got a new cabinet this week, and one of the most interesting people, Emily Thornberry, who I'm afraid I find particularly irritating when I see her on the TV or hear her on the radio. She has been, her nose is out of joint. She was shadow attorney general. But somebody called Richard Hermer has suddenly popped out of nowhere, like they do, turned into a lord. He's not even elected as an MP, and he's been popped in to be Attorney General. So this is Middle East eye of saying fairly positive things about him. And UK appoints new Attorney General critical of Israeli rights violations. But I'm sure I remember reading, it might not be declassified, but one of these other websites saying that he's actually very closely connected to some of the actually pro-Zionist Israeli legal profession in London. So he's completely out of nowhere. Where has this guy come from? Richard Hermer is his name. What they're saying in Middle East Eye, who's the journalist, Ryan Udin, writing in London, says that he opposed the anti-boycott divestment and sanctions bill and was also amongst the Jewish lawyers arguing Israel should respect international law in Gaza. So maybe that's why they've picked him. Anyway, he's not a member of parliament. He will instead be given a life peerage.
Well, I think what's happening here, Starmer is very well connected with the Trilateral Commission, Council on Foreign Relations, MI5, MI6. He's absolutely embedded in that. So he's got a list of things that he's got.
So he's been told Emily Thornberry is actually intellectually not up to the job. What you need is someone who's...
We want a job for this guy. We want him to get a job.
I can't imagine Emily Thornberry, Attorney General.
She could have been it, and she was actually, that was the role she was playing, but she's obviously been pushed out.
She wasn't happy about it.
No, it's going to be.
She waited until Monday this week about issuing a statement saying she was very sorry and surprised, Martin, to continue her work and surprised not to be able to continue her work into government. So this is what happens, isn't it? You do all the hard work, like the local Green councillor we had on here the other week saying that she does all the hard work to get the Greens in, and then literally as the general election is about to happen, when they get a Green MP, she's booted out the Green Party. So this is the way these party politics seems to work, is all the time you're in opposition and out of the way, you can say what you want, you can campaign whatever so that people vote for you, then once it comes to power, they've already decided these are the ones who are going to be in power, and thank you very much for helping us get into power, but cheerio.
Yeah, well, the apparatchik here are fully in charge of the Labour Party now. It's the regional office. We had the elections for Bristol West or Bristol Central, as it now is, for the executive committee. We had to do it on Zoom because it was at the end of the COVID stuff, and we were literally kept waiting for hours and hours and hours. Some people got, there was some kind of a technical glitch. And, of course, a lot of people just had to put the kids to bed or wherever. They disappeared. And then they got in the people they wanted through manipulation of that meeting.
Yeah.
And that's what you're up against.
My main takeaway, though, on this election is that if you're forced to choose between genocide and genocide with a few perks, like, we need to look at the actual system. And, you know, one of the ways I think it should be transformed is for Britain to have, you know, to get off first past the post. We, you know, there are various other systems which afford more representation for, you know, smaller parties to have more influence. I know I can speak on New Zealand. In the 90s, we'd had a big campaign that was, you know, gotta be MMP. You know, I'm not saying that has to be the one, but that there was a big campaign. I don't know who brought it about. I mean, I was a youngster, but we brought that in, and since then the smaller parties have had more of a say.
Yeah.
And people might say, well, does that mean that there's sort of chaos and you can never decide? Well, no, it doesn't seem to be. They pretty much seem to have a big round table of negotiations before they determine the coalition. So what happens is the major parties struggle to get a coalition. They have to form an alliance with the smaller parties. The smaller parties then sort of barter which of their policies that the other party has to adopt, and they come to these agreements, and that and it just seems to bring about. So therefore, if you, it just means there's more representation of different voices.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at the election result, Labour, I think, got around 33% something of the vote, but they get something like 66 odd percent of the seats. That's double the power they've gotten from.
And do you know what? I've heard several times this week Starmer saying, well, we now have the mandate to do this. Blah, 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 blah. Yeah, as no, Martin and everyone else would point out, no, you don't.
Yeah,
you haven't got any mandate, mate.
Don't at all. Well, I mean, it was 22% of the population.
System. Yeah. It's not like...
You weren't arguing the opposite when the Tories were in, weren't you?
No, no.
Yes, you were. When the Tories were here, you were saying, oh, no, they can't. They haven't got a mandate.
No, the Tories have never... Margaret
You're
Thatcher,
right. You were
Margaret
right,
Thatcher never got 50% of the vote in this country.
Mm-mm-mm.
Never.
Okay,
if we'd had a proportional system...
Okay, can we get to the crux of this first past the post thing? Mm-hmm. Because at the crux of it is that you've got these two major parties, neither of whom are going to change the system. Occasionally, you get a little opportunity, like, for example, the... with the Lib Dem coalition in 2010. Now, the Lib Dems should have surely said to the Tories, look, but you've got to change the system.
Well, and they didn't do that. They had the referendum on the single transferable vote, which was lost because the groundwork hadn't been done.
There was no proper
really
campaigning
with the Liberals
on that.
For doing that.
Well, yeah, it was no proper
campaigning.
Because
they basically shot their own fox and our fox as well.
Well, it's time to do a campaign like that. Somebody get it started. Now's the time.
And by the way, under proportional representation, how many MPs would Nigel Farage's party reform have got?
Probably around 60.
93 MPs.
Yeah.
Lots and lots.
And of course, the Greens would have had 40.
Let's not forget that the Greens and these smaller parties, if people could vote for them and didn't feel that they would be wasted if they were voting for them, there may have been far more people voting for these minor parties in a PR system. So that's how important it is.
So many people would have voted for another party, but forced, you know, strategically, that's a smart thing to do. I mean, in the area that I am, it was pretty much the candidates polling were either Conservative or Labour neck and neck, whereas I would have personally preferred to vote Green and or somebody else. But you know, strategically, you are throwing away your vote. Yeah. I'm sorry. I tend That's to right. – this was you know, I have to confess that I didn't do that this time. I didn't even think I was going to get to vote because I didn't think that my ID had come through. And so I, you know, because we just immigrated back here. But it did. I showed up. I was quite surprised that I was on it and I was allowed to vote. So I hadn't put much thought into it. And just in my heart, I was like, I can't vote for genocide. So I didn't. So, but if I thought about it, I'm pretty sure I would have been forced to vote for the Labour person. Which
well, presumably the way the Labour Party won, it's what's his name? It's Kingswood constituency, isn't it?
Yeah, was it Kingswood? Okay, you know,
yeah. Because of course
he's the Mossad guy.
Yes, he's married. He's a gay man, and he's married to an ex US Israeli military officer.
Wow!
That's good old Bristol.
What's been happening is Blair has been not Blair. Starmer has been parachuting these pro-Israeli people in.
Yeah.
And it's all, don't forget all the row about Corbyn's anti-Semitism and so on. This has got the fingerprints of the Israeli embassy all over it. They work really hard to control both parties.
What I'd like to do is I'd like to play you a bit of the mad ceremonial that we get once every 5 years in a new government, which is the, all the various officials at the House of Lords, because they seem to be in charge of the House of Commons somehow. I don't know how it all works, this with the King in charge of the Lords, and the Lords then saying, oh yes, we're going to allow these Commons in now, these little commoners who've just become MPs. But before we do that, there's a few stories. There's this amazing mad thing that's been in the news in the last couple of days, with somebody being found on CCTV last Wednesday on Clifton Suspension Bridge with a holdall with body parts in, being taken up there in a taxi. I don't know if you've come across this, Matt. It's no, in the mainstream all over the country. Yeah. And the most amazing thing for me, Martin, since you've seen it, is that the police are saying that there's no reason to, for people shouldn't approach this guy. He's fine. Listen, the guy's got two holdalls with body parts in, blood dripping out of it, and the police are saying that he's okay. We don't think he's dangerous in any way. Well, what are they talking about?
Well, obviously, we're still, this is a developing story, so we don't really know what's happened here. I've seen the Fitch picture of him, you know, he's a black guy with a beard and a sort of hat. And he went up there in a taxi, and then I don't know what he was thinking of doing with the body parts, from throw him off the bridge or something.
I think,
because
what,
the CCTV up there, just the security.
And
they saw him doing this stuff, and they called the police.
I think we can use a bit of education.
Ran off into Lee Woods.
His plan, it seems, was to chuck these suitcases over the bridge into the water, and maybe as the tide, just to take them out. But, I mean, there's CCTV everywhere. The other thing is, it's a major suicide spot, so there's a constant CCTV
That's
watching
right.
here. Mm-hmm. So anyone that sort of starts to creep out towards them, thinking of throwing themselves off, there's going to be someone around. So this is not the place to throw a body bag of body parts off, you know, because there are going to be people all over the place keeping an eye on you.
Yeah, well, it doesn't sound that smart. I mean, that's why I'm thinking it. Well, I'm thinking, I was talking to my friend about this. It's not like a gangland killing. It's probably something that's like his girlfriend or something like that he's killed and he's trying
apparently,
to get rid
of
the body.
Police have said today there's body parts of two different people in these bags.
Okay, well, it might that could be some gangland aspects to it, but it doesn't sound very professional.
So is he in custody or?
No, he's still.
No, they've got photographs out of the guy all over the national media.
How is it you lock up a journalist for it? You won't lock up somebody carrying around body parts.
Well, they've got to find him
first.
They've
got to find him first, yeah. He's still running around.
He's at large.
Yeah.
Okay,
he's at large,
sense.
Yeah. So we'll be keeping an eye open
people,
for this.
People try to bury their body in Barton Hill. You know, they had to put it in a shed, and they said it was drugs and somebody to look after it for them. But it wasn't. It was actually body parts of the girl that this guy had killed. That's a more sensible place to hide a body, in somebody's garden shed, rather than take it into the CCTV on the bridge. You know, that doesn't sound like he knows what he's doing at all. But there you are.
I mean, not much to say about this other than... this just the general state of violence and police. What on earth is going on? You know, the policing. Mm. We've got police that seem to be tracking people for saying the wrong thing on social media, but then they're not really concentrating on cases like this.
Well, they were there in 10 minutes.
We also
they've taken loads of forensics.
Yeah, okay, so there's a 999 call. Are they going to come to something else with a 999 call? But I mean, the point is, for example, we had in the BBC were covering it amazingly, was the Lloyds Bank Business Support Unit destroying companies here, and they're actually police detectives working for the company and with the company. And so it took a new police crime commissioner coming along, whatever it was, 4 or 5 years ago, and Lloyds Bank moved out the city immediately, because there's all I'm saying is that there is always, you know, always suspicions of police corruption, police taking two salaries, you know, one from the gangsters and the criminals, and this does indicate that the police have not been, you know, concentrating on possible violent crime going on or responding to it properly. But anyway, we'll see how they get on. The other story,
so perhaps there is an argument for robot police dogs, but yeah, who's programming? We need open source, and
I think you just need more actual detectives who are doing detective work rather than people who are tick box police.
But what's happened? You know, what's happened in
real human beings out there trying to find criminals?
What's
crime.
Just happened is in Old Market. As when they had the last Labour government, they built a state-of-the-art police station, Trinity Road Police Station there. State-of-the-art, you know, in the right in the centre of the community, a place where people could walk in. Then, when the Tories came after 2008, they decided they were going to have an austerity budget, so they cut the police's budget. They sacked 20,000 officers, and they said, we can't afford to keep this police station. Mm. Now, it was then left empty for quite a while. And, of course, because it's a police station, it's got no windows. So you can't just turn it into flats. And so it has now been completely levelled now. So we built this state-of-the-art police station, and now we've just demolished it because they don't know what to do with it, because they haven't got the police officers to put in it, and they're going to build luxury flats on what used to be a state-of-the-art police station.
Just the latest on this, the crime... apparently, this guy may have been recognised by the police because they're concentrating now in West London. They believe that he brought these suitcases from London, travelled from London to Bristol with the suitcases found on Clifton Suspension Bridge on the early hours of the Thursday, July the 11th, were believed to contain the bodies of two adult men. And so the police are out in West London looking for, I guess, this guy. So anyway, that's one bizarre story, but... what about the yesterday's big story about water and the water industry? I don't know if you've been following that one as well, Matt. You obviously, you know, you're not one of the mainstream media types, which is absolutely fine.
That's right.
So the water industry is now saying that there's going to be big increases in bills, but the water companies themselves, in this standoff with Ofwat, the regulator, so-called regulator, they're saying, oh, well, actually, these increases in the bills are not going to be enough.
Yeah, because, I mean, basically, the Thames Water is bankrupt. It should never... I mean, this is classic sort of Thatcherite nonsense, but all of these utility infrastructures were privatised, and it's just...
And as Fergal Sharkey is saying, that all of these billions, these tens and tens of billions of pounds have been sucked out of the industry... by the shareholders of these
businesses. And they're paying dividends out to the shareholders, even though they're under investigation for, basically throwing sewage in the water. Incidentally,
are they really under investigation? Well, no, I think they just do it with impunity.
I think they do it with impunity. But the citizen investigators who are looking into it all, because they measure, it's
so there was a chance with this Labour government. I mean, they're talking about railway nationalisation, aren't they? Renationalisation. There was a chance, surely, that this Labour government could have said, right, this is so bad, we're now going to bring the water companies back into public ownership and start to deliver water at cost. No, what's happening instead is that private, we're talking here about private equity mainly, these massive pension fund managers are saying, we're going to refinance these these companies, and we will only allow this refinancing of these companies if they up the bills.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening.
Well,
so we could have had a government that was intervening here to stop this water dumping and stop the fleecing and the racket all around the country of water by these private businesses. But no, this wonderful new Labour government...
mandate.
Yeah.
With their wonderful mandate. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I mean, the water
company... doing nothing.
Yeah, well, what they do... The whole talk about renationalising the rails, it was a kind of sop to keep us all...
Well, they may actually do it, because several of the rail companies are actually now in public...
Well, that's right, because...
I think as
the franchises run out, they can just take them back
rail?
In-house. They could always have done that in any case. They didn't do it. I mean, during the years of the Blair government, they could have done it, but they...
So why aren't they doing it with water, Martin? These aren't really Labour people at all, are they? They're just working for private equity.
Yes, I know, but I don't think there's much point in spending taxpayers' money on renationalising them. You should just let them go bankrupt, yeah? Let them take the loss, and then we'll take it over when it's gone bankrupt, because we don't want to spend any money on this. Why should we give the shareholders any more money to take over the company? We should just make them lose money, and then we take over all the assets for nothing. But they may be forced to do that as we go into a major economic crisis.
Well, our MP, Carla Denyer, our wonderful new green MP, writing in the Metro today. I'm not sure if she's got any power. Has she got any power?
Well,
she's just a talking shop
power of the platform
type person. Private water companies need to tap out, she says. It's time to nationalise. This is in tomorrow's Metro. It's just been published on their website. It's deplorable. If private water companies get their way, your bill could be rising by 44%, all while they're still paying their shareholders' dividends. That would mean an extra 183 out of your pocket over the next 5 years. Regulator Ofwat stepped in and said it wants firms to limit rises for households to £19 a year, which is 21%, until 2030. Hang on, 21% increase in water fees. Look, this is fueling inflation, isn't it? And actually, what we're doing is we're by our inability to regulate these industries or to keep them in public ownership, we're stabbing ourselves in the back. What we're doing is we're upping the cost of living crisis, making it worse.
Mm. Well, that's right. And of course, as I say, what may happen is they're going to inherit a massive geopolitical crisis. You know, if we're going to go to war with Lebanon, there's going to be a big row about that. And the other thing is that there's going to be
an. They dare.
Well, I mean, what's happening in the Red Sea? Well, it's the Israelis who are going to decide. Yeah. They're going to decide.
Do you really
war
think
with
they're going to go to war with these people? Or is it may be just a scaremongering, no, saber rattling.
Well, no, well, you don't presume so. Is all I will say about
fair
that.
Fair enough. No idea.
And of course, in the Red Sea, if the Houthis, you know, if it really kicks off, there's going to be things like a stock. The oil price is going to go through the roof. There's going to be a stock market crash. And of course, the Americans blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline over a year ago.
What?
Yeah, but I mean, but that is actually stabbing the whole, you know, basically trashing the whole European economy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, yeah, I was living in Berlin, and the prices were going up like 8 times the energy bills. Yeah. And people just didn't, you know, it's like, do you realize why? It's, you know, you just, well, you would have got cheap
evil, it's that
gas
evil Putin
from Russia.
The evil Putin, that's why. I
mean, Martin,
bombed his own pipeline. Yeah, if people really knew what was going on, you know, pay attention, like, bless all of you listening to this podcast, you know, station. Good on you, because it's incumbent on us to find truthful information, and bless people like Declassified UK. But if people really knew, like, who was causing all the problems in the world, we could solve them, yeah, imagine the fact that they think they can pull that one over us, that Putin blew up his own pipeline, and I loved what Putin said in the news conference about that, just totally deadpan. Yeah, they say that I blew up our pipeline, but if I wanted to stop it, I would just go down and turn it off.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous.
He didn't need to, did he, really?
No. I mean, they stood to make trillions of dollars from it. It would seem a little bit like shooting yourself in the foot. But yeah, it's not hard to find the truth of all this stuff. It's it's just that our media mainstream. No, I don't even want to give them that credit. They're not mainstream anymore. When you've got someone like Joe Rogan rates higher than CNN and Fox, they're the legacy media. They don't seem to want to report on the truth.
Yeah, I do find it rather amusing when you see some BBC person tweeting and is like, no retweets, nothing. You know, this is supposed to be, you know, your finger's supposed to be on the pulse, man.
Yeah, right.
But nothing
it's
at all.
It's true, isn't it?
Okay, so Keir Starmer's Labour Party has been boosted by £20 million from just 11 donors. This is who they are. And this is a great little article in the Daily Express, which has suddenly become a great newspaper of great favour because they're in opposition to the present government. I mean, even though it's owned by the same people as the Daily Mirror, which is the pro-Labour side, this is how it works, folks. So you've got the Express pro-Tory, the Mirror pro-Labour, but both owned by Reach PLC. We have taken a look at the 11 donors who have boosted the Labour Party. So there's a whole list here. I mean, the point is you've got Lord David Sainsbury, 7.6 million. The Union of Shop, Distributive and Allied Workers, 4.6 million. Crikey, I didn't know they had that much money. Ecotricity, based in Stroud. This is Dale Vince's company, which just sells you electricity, but takes a little bit extra off of it, saying it's going towards some sort of renewable thing, which it probably is. But they really don't generate electricity. They just take a little bit of money off your bill. Anyway, he's got 3.3 million quid sloshing around. He's decided to give to the Labour Party, not the Greens, because apparently the Greens don't take money from these sorts of corporates. Anyway, they've got a whole list here, but this is becoming just another Tory party, isn't it?
Well, no, what's happening is the business classes and the City of London. There's a very good article about Rachel Reeves's relationship to the City of London. They're going to bring in loads of private finance initiatives. In other words, they're not going to spend
money. Well, Labour invented it.
Well, that's right. And they're going to, instead of investing public money in infrastructure, which is what we need to do, they're going to go into partnership with private equity. They will build the stuff and then they will own it and take a rent from it going into the indefinite future. It's economic idiocy. Mm. but they're doing it because they're in the pocket of the City of London. You know, and this is how it works. The Tories are in power for ages and ages and ages because they can cling on and cling on and cling on. Then when you finally get them out, the people who come in are in the pockets of the same people that were funding the Tory party in the first place. And you can't get round this because you're forced to vote for the Labour Party to keep the other side out. So then that's what it does. It just locks everything down. And of course, what they did in New Zealand, they managed to break out of that. And they did it, but instead of trying to change the leadership of the Labour Party, they changed the electoral system by knocking on everybody's door and having a referendum. And of course, they were able to do that because it's a smaller place. And also, it was just in the 1980s when that was going on and the revolution in Labour politics in New Zealand, that was just when the All Blacks were teaching the Northern Hemisphere teams how to play rugby because they couldn't play rugby up to that point. They'd never worked out how to do it. And of course, they were just faster and better. You know, I remember a hooker from New Zealand dropping a goal from play. Absolutely unheard of previously that a forward would do something like that, but everybody's got to play every position. And of course, when they were doing that, I mean, New Zealand was a can-do country in the 1880s, the first one to give a women a vote.
Yeah.
And the first ones to create a welfare state in the 1930s.
Yeah. That's right. First woman vote by 50 years, I think it was.
Yeah, 50 years before.
That's incredible.
Because they were known as a liberal country, and then they became a Labour country. So in the 1930s, in Sweden, the Labour Party won the election, and they started building a welfare state. And people go, "You can't do that. You'll never be able to afford that."
Well, maybe we should all move. Right. Maybe we should all move to New Zealand, or maybe just adopt New Zealand policies.
I would argue
renationalisation.
Well, that's one of the things they did.
Proportional representation.
Rogenomics.
Do you want to say something, please, Matt, about the PR system that did get adopted? Is it?
MMP, you get a...
What does it stand for?
Oh, gosh, I knew you were going to ask me that.
I'll look it up for you.
Yeah, I mean, I was probably 12 when it came in. I remember the campaign and, you know, catchy slogan, gotta be MMP. Anyway, there are other systems, so I wouldn't say it has to be MMP. Around Europe, you've got different proportional systems. I think the UK is quite unique in that it's still got this
mixed member proportional representation.
Right. And so how that one works anyway, that's what I can speak to, is that you get a party vote and a local candidate vote. So that means, if you're kind of forced to choose between a local person that, you know, you can do that, but you can still give a vote to the Greens. There is a number of seats for the local reps. So whoever gets in on that gets in on that. But then there's a whole other bunch of seats. I can't tell you exactly what the proportion is, but they are assigned for the parties to be split up proportionally. Then it's not that, there's this sort of government, you know, you sort of brought up, would Farage's party have X many, you know, seats? Not necessarily, because the government is formed, in terms of the government, the majority, that is then formed by, a coalition if it needs to be. Sometimes you can still win outright, but usually what's happened is they need to form some sort of a coalition.
The point is, do you think it's working in New Zealand?
I think it's definitely an improvement, a huge improvement. It's not perfect, but it's a big improvement. Yes, I do. Because you get Labour and then they have to make some concessions to the Greens, you know, and it does work. It's not sort of this out of control, you know, they come to terms of agreement before they come into power.
So maybe this is why all the oligarchs seem to come to London. This is a little bit easier to get their way.
And there's also more of a cap. The other part of it, I think, is crucial to having a real democracy. You know, you need truth. You need a better electoral system, but you also need to take money out of the political campaigns. I'm very interested what people's ideas about that are, but certainly capping donations. You know, Bernie Sanders is a big advocate for publicly funded elections. So each party has a certain amount of finance and a campaign platform to use to spread their message. Various ways to do it that don't involve a slush fund, you know, where it's just becoming, you know, bribery. And it's just, you know, you talk about, it's just a capitalist takeover of the state. So we've got to get the money out of politics somehow.
That seems to be a sensible way to do it, you know, per vote or something. But one of the things that upsets me, I mean, I find it really, you know, I think the whole idea is to just demoralise everyone so no one even bothers to vote, and probably most of them just leave the country anyway. Is the way they keep recycling these failed politicians like David Cameron. Now we've got Ed Miliband is back. Yes, he's a wonderful MP. Yes, and first thing he's done is he said no, there will be no more. He's vetoed their own policy, the Labour Party policy, and said there's going to be no more licences given to drill any oil, and also is apparently going to be banning these petrol vehicles and diesel vehicles even quicker than he has to. So here is, this is recorded just before the election, here's Alan Miller from the Together Declaration talking about the plan to ban these fossil fuel vehicles quicker than they even have to.
We're talking about motorbikes and cars. You know, there's 37 million car drivers in Britain and 1.5 million motorbikers. They all vote. And they're very concerned about the internal combustion engine bans, the idea that petrol and diesel cars and engines are going to be banned, electrification, without, again, proper scrutiny, right? I mean, electrification. Where the cobalt, the copper, where does it come from? The mining, young children, the fact that you use furnaces and carbon to create these things, the whole situation of the weight of them setting on fire, breaking more things on the roads and car parks. What happens when you can't use them after a short period of time? The cost to replace them, where do they go? These are all discussions, right? We should have them, and you know, electrification points and what that all means, right? Because all these buzzwords come out, but what's the reality of it? Carbon has enabled us to have wealth, right, across the world, to transform ourselves. What we need to do is think about the next 100 years, next 500 years, bold planning, innovation, investment, but have the public at the heart of it. That's the thing, right? Now, what was interesting today is that Nigel Farage came down. We asked all the candidates to come and speak to us and have an interview. Some couldn't make today or the Times, but hardly anyone responded. But he came down and he addressed the bikers and said his views on the net zero situation and on, you know, shouldn't be banning these things. And I think it's really important that we do this up and down the country, that we get in front of candidates. We've got a Together pledge on net zero that insists on transparency. Every Democrat should sign it go out, and we've got five pledges that we've asked all of our members and supporters to go to candidates with and put it to them about care, healthcare and the NHS as well, about free speech and debanking and platforming, about the Public Health Act, the WHO. Key things about our situation, our privacy, our rights, our autonomy. So we'd encourage everyone to do that. It's not just about the election, though, obviously. We campaign throughout the year, 360 approach, grassroots, local, regionally, nationally, and we encourage everyone to get involved in that project.
Yeah, so that's Alan Miller from the Together Declaration. You first on this, Matt. What do you make of this? There seems to be almost a consensus out there. I'm not sure if I dare to call it that, but the net zero policies are being sort of, we're just being told this is going to happen. There's no kind of discussion, very little discussion about the idea of getting rid of petrol and diesel cars. And the other thing is, you look across the world to China, well, they're not doing any of this. And we're on a planet which goes, you know, the air goes round in the planet. And so what's the point of us doing this to ourselves? Almost like trying to stop ourselves developing. And maybe using nuclear, maybe that's the idea, that we've got to use lots of nuclear, which is megally expensive. So anyway, what do you make of the sort of points he's raising there about getting rid of petrol and diesel?
It's something we've got to do, and then what is the best way to do it? That's the question. I think it is clear that we cannot keep continuing to burn fossil fuels, and I don't personally like the argument Well, not obviously. It's not about absolute. It's just about how, you know, what's the best practice, isn't it, to move forward? Obviously, there needs to be a transition, and you need to mitigate the impact on people like commuters, you know, with who already have those cars. You know, how can we make this work?
Cheap,
but we do need
cheap
to do it.
Public transport.
Yeah,
I mean, there's
there
nothing.
We go.
There's nothing basically. I mean, they even last year they reduced the number of buses in Bristol by about something like 30%. So there's also parts of Bristol. Like Long Ashton, they've no longer got bus services, or parts of Long Ashton anyway. So what's the the pips are squeaking in the world of public transport. In other words, these private companies are trying to get more and more profit out of the buses. So the bus that doesn't make enough money, oh, well, just forget it. And the subsidies. Anyway, so what I'm saying is there doesn't seem to be any actual consideration of the public in any of this.
Yeah, I mean, that's well, a common theme, anyway. Isn't it? And it comes back to the whole... the slush fund system, the bribery system, and politicians coming in, and yeah, privatizing. I mean, a Labour Party that's coming in and not nationalizing. You know, they're furthering privatization. They've shifted more and more to the centre, to the point where they're on the right, I'd say, centre right. And well, that just told, doesn't seem to work. It's just not efficient.
Look, okay, there's this whole business of diesel and petrol.
Yeah.
Diesel, look at, I've just looked into this. There's a very good article on The Conversation, fact check. Are diesel cars really more polluting than petrol cars? Actually, it turns out, no, they're not. And, but, you know, there's a sort of, we were told 10 years ago by Ed Miliband, buy diesel cars because they're far less carbon comes out per mile of a diesel car, half roughly, than a petrol car. But now we're told, oh no, those particulates are coming out too, and they're really bad. But now, if you look in this article, it's an excellent compilation of the various research. They're saying there's almost exactly as much in the way of these particulates coming out of petrol cars as come out of diesel cars. So there seems to be a game being played here. Certainly, if you buy diesel, you're getting more energy out of diesel than you do out of petrol. It's just got more embodied energy in the fuel. So there's a bit of a game where the idea is, look, you know, we're going to keep the prices of these things exactly the same. And in fact, the whole price of energy is being just upped and upped and upped so that the new nuclear that's coming online starts to look like it's more affordable. So everything's expensive gas. And anyway, Martin, what do you make of all this, the net zero move towards having no petrol and diesel?
Well, I mean, it's aspirational. And you can see the Greens, for example, will be pushing for this sort of agenda. So they did reasonably well. If they had a proportional system, they'd have got 40 MPs. This is the sort of thing they'd be pushing for.
Sorry to interrupt you, but one of the interesting things I've just popped up here, I just clicked it, is the link in the RAC article and the Conversation one. You click on it and it says, this is where the government proves and shows that diesel only emits half the carbon per mile as petrol. You click on it and the government webpage says not found. So they've taken the webpage down.
Yeah, well, I mean,
it's a game. They're playing games with us.
Yes, and so in other words, this is sort of aspirational. This is sort of the sort of thing that middle class families who recycle, the sort of things they want, or they think they want. They don't really haven't really thought. The other thing, as you mentioned, public transport. Why do we need new kinds of cars? Maybe we don't need any cars. We need mass transit, public transport,
and taxis.
And yeah. That's right.
Cabs
are public. So the idea, what we're doing with the electric car boondoggle is we're going to carry on having the same old lifestyle where people commute 40 k's to work every day in a car.
How much did they just pay?
They're going to be electric
Tesla
cars.
Tesla have just paid off Elon Musk a massive amount, haven't they? They had a 20% drop in sales of Tesla cars, and Elon Musk has managed to do some sort of mega deal. Well, he's taken a massive amount of money out of it. I think he's just decided, right, that's enough of that. Let's move on to the next thing.
Yeah, well, I mean...
Is he out?
No, he's still in, but he's took a massive deal. I'm not sure how many billion it was.
Yeah, but
massive. I'll look it up, but it was a colossal amount of money. So people like him, it seems to me like what they're involved in is they know what the next big thing is going to be. They invest in it. They make a fortune out of it. And then once it starts to sink, because it was rubbish in the first place, they're on to the next game.
Well, the other thing I've meant...
Is that too cynical, Matt?
I couldn't tell you. I don't know the details of that one.
Can I just say what the second point I wanted to make, which is that we talked earlier about the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. It's quite clear that energy pipelines and oil and gas are going to be fundamental to the conduct of World War III, as they were fundamental to the conduct of World War II. And, of course... in that situation, if we're going to go to war with Russia and China, we can't negotiate with them about fixing the climate. It's just impossible, you know. We've got to change our attitude towards those things. And they're saying, well, we'd like to talk to you about that, but can you get your boot out of our face, please? And this is what we're dealing with. And, of course, the blowing up of the Nord Stream, the Greens in Germany have accepted this whole, you know, the agenda of we've got to go to zero, net zero, so they've got to close the nuclear power station. But they're also the ones banging the drum for we've got to go to war with Russia, which is very demoralizing. For
if they don't like nuclear, that's probably a bad idea. So we're well, in
mean,
their
they're,
faces
they're going
with
to
lose.
I mean, the talk in NATO, the NATO conference this week about how they're going to go to war with Russia and all the rest of it.
We're going to do that after the break, Martin.
Well, I'm just pointing out that when we're talking about all this climate change stuff, there's going to be a big climate change when the nuclear bombs hit us.
Nuclear winter, maybe. Yeah.
That really, well, that 50, really will cause.
By the way, Elon Musk took $56 billion out of Tesla. That is. End of last month, and his net worth, by the way, is also down $11 billion because the rally of Tesla shares has ended. Basically, it's come to an end. All that. So when your sales in 1 year are down 20%, and you're pushing loads of new models and etc. on the market, then you know, might as well walk away.
If people
away
have got
from
any
it.
Money, they ain't going to buy new electric cars, are they?
But the point is, the money's been sucked in by investors who think they're going to make loads of cash out of this over the last decade or so, and they have.
As long as you sell
now,
the shares at the right
now
point,
it's
you're
time
all right.
to leave, folks.
But what do you think, Tony? Do you think that electric is worse than fossil fuels?
I think you should have a bit of a balance. Yes, I think it generally is. Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those. Yeah, unless you've got. So, for example, trams running on electric, just for a car. I mean, if you look at the glum faces of the people at Severn Bridge services waiting for their cars to charge up so they can get home, sitting around drinking coffee and hoping that they're going to get somewhere. And also the massive amount of mining that goes into building these things. And also, well, there's another thing, which is the incredible replacement cost for a battery. The fact that we reported on this show about 3 or 4 months ago, maybe 2 months ago, that the resale values of these cars is plummeting, like after the first few months of buying them, because the quality of the actual miles you're even getting out of the cars are no good. No, I think they're a gimmick, basically.
Right.
Ultimately,
those are all fair points. But how do you feel about the global warming? Are you do you believe in fossil fuel climate
change? I think we should have public transport. I think we should have trains.
Yeah.
I think we should have buses and trains.
Agreed.
And taxis. And we should get rid of this obsession with the car. In fact, one of my reports. My report, which I did about 5-6 years ago, well, maybe longer than that, for RT, was into Dr. Beeching and the relationship with the American oil companies and why they closed the railways in this country was because the Americans said, look, if you want to dig out some North Sea oil, you're going to depress the world oil price. And so the Americans said, well, we'll let you do the North Sea oil. We'll finance it and everything, give you the money for the oil rigs and the energy companies, but only if you open up a domestic market in oil. So that's when they started building motorways. Oh, they started shutting railways. Should have decent public transport. If you've got decent public transport, you don't need any of this pollution everywhere. You get one train,
right.
A diesel, puffing out smoke, whatever. I'm sure it's terrible.
Totally.
But you've got thousands of people on that train. And especially if it's at cost. Of course it isn't now. £250 return from Bath to London.
Yeah.
An open return. I mean, what a joke.
I totally agree. These sensible policies are much more efficient. You know, they say capitalism provides basis of competition, which makes things more efficient. No, it doesn't. Not if that's your only ruling philosophy, cooperation. And things that don't merely provide shareholders with maximum profit, that doesn't tend to create more efficient stuff. It's just clear, you know, you've got your closures of these, you know, water privatized companies as well. It just shows, we need certain things to be publicly owned and run sensibly. With public interest in mind. You know, some people think the government is corrupt and therefore we should move. I totally get it. They are. But we need to solve that problem rather than putting everything into the hands of corporations, which you have even less control over.
Correct.
So we do need to have some balance. Obviously, there's a danger with putting all the power into a state. But, there's a balance to be struck there. And well,
in a way, you're not. You see, if
that,
you're nationalising, what you do is you just let boards run everything, and those boards are open to the public, and they run it all at cost. Anyway, we're going to have a break now, and we'll have a quick listen to the Weird Houses of Parliament ceremony, where they open up the Parliament once every 5 years for a new Parliament, and the Lords and the King sort of... I think the King is supposed to be there, but he doesn't actually turn up, and they just pretend he is there or something. But anyway, rather than listening to their speeches, I thought we'd have a listen to the sort of strangeness of the Houses of Parliament and how they actually run things. And maybe, just maybe, Matt will be joining us after the break.
Sandinista. Every day they stand up and perjure. They're the masters of torture and murder. Don't believe what you hear from the media. They're the ones who kill Victor Jara. Don't believe
see what you hear from Chile. They're the ones who toppled Allende. In the liberation of Zimbabwe, they were there to try to stop Mugabe. If you don't believe that they're evil, look what they've done to the Cambodian people. Nixon, Reagan, they all the same. Constantly the down press again. If you trust the Pentagon, you wind up in Vietnam. Nixon, Reagan, they all the same. Constantly the down press again. Do you want them to represent you? Do you want them to run the country? Do you want them to run the world? Do you want them to make your decisions? Do you want them to make up your minds? Do you want them to be your masters? Do you want them to rule your fate? No, no. To pollute the ocean? Do you want that to poison the earth? Do you want that to rob our resources? Do you want that to steal all our wealth? Do you want that to devastate the forest? Do you want that to kill all the species? Do you want that? We don't want that, no vision, no fission. We don't want that, no build more reactors. We don't want that, stop nuclear matters. We don't want that, to start using head. We don't want that, to get on the good. We don't want that, to get out the lead. Yes, yes. Do you want that to get up and get it? Do you want that to go out and get it? Do you want that? But now is the time. Yes, yes. CIA. CIA. Strong right arm of the USA. CIA. CIA. Strong arm thugs of the USA. They're the ones who killed Che Guevara, all because they want to liberate Cuba. Now they're out to march Nicaragua with their plans to squash Sandinista. Every day they slander and perjure. They're the masters of torture and murder. Don't believe what you hear from the media. They're the ones who kill Victor Jara. Don't believe what you hear about Chile. They're the ones who topple Allende. In the liberation of Zimbabwe, they were there to try to stop Mugabe. If you don't believe that they're evil, look what they've done to the Cambodian people. CIA. CIA. Strong right arm of the USA. CIA. CIA. Strong arm thugs of the USA. We'll be right back.
great chap, Dr. John. I had one of those albums in the car. I remember 1275 Mini back in the, I guess, what was it, the mid 1980s. And yeah, great stuff. You never hear it on the radio, of course, but you do hear. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Broadcasting from Easton tonight with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and Matt, whose second name I still can't... I look at it, but I got...
O'Brannon,
that's actually quite easy, isn't it? It's not that complicated. I'll write it down phonetically here, so it's easier to say for the credits at the end of the show. O'Brannon.
Yeah, it's the Irish fada on the A. It makes it like an O sound, O'Brannon.
Now let's with the music. I'm sorry, last week I mean people do sometimes say, get a bit fusspotty with me about the music. What was that music? Oh, you must announce it. And I normally do after the break. So what we had there was, we began with the Pontadoulas, or I'll probably pronounce that, well, it's Welsh. Welsh male voice choir with a song called Comrades in Arms. Recorded in 2006. We then had the rather peculiar, someone sent me this, thank you so much, folks, for sending me these weird things. This guy's called Dan Del Santo, and he's from the 70s, quite clearly. He's wearing all his 70s gear, and singing that song is called CIA, and it's all about how the CIA are trying to control the world. Mm-hmm. Some kind of crazy Laurel Valley, probably Californian musician from the late 60s and early 70s. His name again, Dan Del Santo. The track, C.I.A. And finally, then, of course, Dr. John with the Quitters Never Win. Martin, we've really got to look at this. I mean, straight away, as soon as Starmer's elected, his first job, appoints his cabinet, and straight away, they're off to Washington.
Yeah, well, it's very... I mean, obviously, the timing of this was...
4th of July.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, but I mean... The
4th of July election, off to America.
Yeah, well, I mean, the timing, because, of course, Sunak, who decided when the election was going to be, so presumably this NATO thing was set up a long time previously. Well, as you saw, Biden...
Sunak never decides anything. He's told what to do.
Well, indeed, but I mean, they've gathered them all there to be told what to do. And of course, what they're doing is doubling down in the Ukraine, and of course, they're also doubling down in support for the Israelis. Mm. Now, what you mentioned earlier is quite interesting, because Starmer said at the NATO conference that he was okay with British Storm Shadow missiles being fired into Russia proper, because this has been an issue for some while now. They said for some while ago, because even when the Americans were umming and ahhing, Sunak said, no, they can use our missiles to fire into Russia. So they called the British ambassador in Moscow and said, you do realise if you do that, we're going to fire back, and we're going to fire back at you in Britain. Mm. If you hit our bases, we can fire back at your bases, and we will. Yeah. So
have
a think about it.
British foreign policy, you know, some people say online, I've commented, like, that to the Labour is more Tory than Tory, they're more dangerous, and then someone fired back, look, I don't care about kids in Gaza, I care about local, and I'm like, okay, look, fair enough, if you don't want to extend your humanity to Gaza, fine, that's on you, okay, but you got to consider a more violent foreign policy could come back to smack you in the face. You know, violence begets violence.
And even if it doesn't, they will manufacture an attack.
Well, anyway, what's happened, as you said earlier, Tony, is the MOD, civil servants at the MOD, immediately stepped up and said, no, we haven't agreed to that.
Mm-hmm. So who's in charge? I thought Starmer was supposed to. We've just elected him, but the Ministry of Defence are just saying,
well,
no,
I think
no,
it's because the Ministry of Defence have a direct line to the Russians, and they know what's going to happen, because they've been told.
And possibly it's just a sort of higher level.
If you do that, we are going, you know, you can't just fire at our stuff. I mean, the Russians suspect that attack on the Sebastopol beach, which killed two children, that was clearly an American missile directed by the Americans.
We're going to talk about that that in a minute, you know, Martin. Yeah, but please, saying, can we just focus on this for a second? Because the Daily Telegraph yesterday published an article, UK hasn't allowed Ukraine to use Storm Shadow missiles inside Russia. Ministry of Defence clarifies, correcting what the Prime Minister said. So Zelensky appears to distance himself as well from earlier comments after the source said he permission had been granted. So it's Starmer's immediately been put back in his box by the security state here. Britain's been forced to clarify it has not been given permission for Ukraine to use Storm Shadow missiles to strike inside Russia in an awkward diplomatic moment for Sir Keir Starmer. Downing Street said on Thursday government policy had not changed regarding the deployment of the long-range missiles, despite comments from the Prime Minister that said he was loosening restrictions on how the missiles are used. The British government allowed Kiev to fire the missiles against targets in Crimea and mainland Ukraine since they were delivered last year, but has banned the country from using them to hit targets inside Russia. Officials are concerned a move would escalate the war and could draw the UK into a conflict with Russia, Martin.
Well, that's right. And, of course, the Russians immediately called in the British ambassador and read him a riot act. You know, because we're
not so sure about that. I think maybe what's happened here is the Minister of Defence just said, what the hell does he think he's talking about? He and Zelensky are having a little chit-chat, but they're not in charge. We are.
Well, that's right. And, of course, what's actually happening is these the bien pensant liberal opinion is still totally behind the idea that the Ukrainians are just poor little guys being picked on by the terrible Russians. And of course, Stalin's completely bought into this narrative.
I don't think he's bought into it in the sense that he believes it. It's a convenient truth.
Well, he's going along
this
with it.
This is a gravy train. This is a gravy train. Keir Starmer is on a gravy train.
Oh, yeah.
And he thinks to himself, the more I say the terrible things about Russia, the more my gravy train is going to chug along, the more steam is going
to
come out.
It's virtue signalling to the American deep state about how loyal we are. And of course, we're actually regarded as a bit of embarrassment, because when we were pushing to push these missiles and we were saying the Americans were umming and ahhing, but we went first and said, they can use the British missile. And the Americans said, no, we're going to decide that. We're trying to be so eager to please that we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah.
Well, the Americans haven't even decided they want to do this yet, but the British have already. But, you know, we're like the sort of sidekick of the bully. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
On this show a few months ago, I interviewed a chap called Dr. David Hughes from Lincoln University. His paper, in fact, a book, in fact, The Nazis, Wall Street, the Nazis and the Crimes of the Deep State. Fantastic stuff. And he's looking very, very much at the links as well with the Anglo-Zionist Empire and the Operation Paperclip, the sort of things that I was looking into in my book, The Traitors of Arnhem, that is to say, the deals done between Winston Churchill's private secretary, Desmond Morton, and Adolf Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann, who was supposed to have disappeared but didn't. And the Daily Express in the 1970s had a massive front page headline, Martin Bormann is alive. But everyone's supposed to have forgotten about all that. Anyway, his take, in fact, this is a clip, I don't think we used it at the time, but it's a clip from a longer interview, talks about this thing called the dual state. And this idea of Starmer over in Washington yesterday getting embarrassed by being sort of put back in his box by the MOD rather swiftly in the Daily Telegraph, is this idea of the dual state. So there's a sort of something which is shoved out there for the public, and there's something else completely different going on behind the scenes.
So the dual state was a term that was used by Hans Morgenthau initially in 1955. And he drew a distinction between what he called the regular state hierarchy, which is the kind of the visible state that we all see and are familiar with, but also a security hierarchy as well. And the security hierarchy kind of operates in the background. So the regular hierarchy, it's visible, it obeys the rule of law and so on. But the security hierarchy in the background monitors and controls that regular hierarchy and is capable of exercising veto power over it, often in terms of emergency measures taken in the name of security. So Ola Tunander wrote some really interesting stuff about this, and you can link it, of course, to ideas previously about the invisible government. But when we get into the kind of age of security in the early 1950s or even late 1940s, We are talking NATO, of course. And what Tunanda argues is that with an organization like NATO, even though you seem to have lots of separate countries, each with their own kind of security organizations, in actual fact, the whole thing is what he calls a kind of a U.S. Super state. And actually the U.S., perhaps you might want to say Anglo-American intelligence, kind of has this kind of oversight of the whole thing and is capable of stepping in and exercising veto power at any moment. And that ultimately was what led into, for instance, the Gladio stay behind armies, which were run by NATO. And you mentioned Vincent Guerra, and of course all of that stuff really came to the fore in the 1970s. So, in other words, a lot of this has only come to light in relatively recent years. But when you take it back, you can find that there are these kind of hidden power structures and arrangements in place right from the very beginning of the post-World War II or early Cold War period. And actually, much of what we've seen over the last few decades are these power structures becoming ever more visible, to the point where with COVID, for those who are willing to look and investigate, they're really quite obvious.
So that's Dr. David Hughes from Lincoln University speaking to me a few months ago. In fact, he did a fantastic interview on what's really in the COVID jabs, which has done incredibly well, which was a compilation in a way, a kind of selection from all the different reports where people have found rather strange things inside. We're talking about something like between 50 and 80 labs around the world saying, well, this doesn't look right, this shouldn't be in here, into the COVID vaccines, these experimental vaccines produced by Pfizer, Moderna and the rest of them, but not, of course, the Chinese. Martin's favourite Chinese Sinovac is traditional type of vaccine.
Did you see what happened about that? It's come to light in the Philippines. They didn't know whether Sinovac would work or not, but the Pentagon pushed out a load of stuff about how Sinovac was dangerous, people shouldn't use it, and you know, not that they had any knowledge about whether it was any good or not, but they were just trying to get ahead of the game and sort of prevent the Philippines from, you know, getting cheaper vaccines from China. And of course, the other thing that we know from at the very early stages is the Israeli Defense Forces were tipped off in November 2019, before the Chinese knew there was a pandemic, that there was going to be a pandemic coming out of China. Now, I think that's what Sherlock Holmes would call a clue about what was happening here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was actually developed. It looks as if it's a bio-warfare weapon. Mm. Kirillov...
Martin, we're not going into this again.
All right, but
we've been into it week after week.
But
we've got stuff to do here.
Yes,
yeah?
Well,
make your point
if we're talking about Ukraine, one of the things that the Russian army did when they first went in there is they captured a lot of biolabs. And in those biolabs, they found COVID-19.
Now, there's a good point.
That's right. And then Kirillov has been to the United Nations Security Council with all the evidence they've got. The Iranian National Revolutionary Guard Corps head Salami, he said, we think this is a bio
weapon. Tons of evidence for it, actually. Yeah. I don't know how you feel on that, Martin, but
it's piling up.
But there's documents showing with Fauci's name, NIH gain of function research. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago in the US, they had a Senate hearing, and one of the guys working with Fauci did admit, finally, under oath, that they did do gain of function research and fund it in the Wuhan lab, and there's labs in Ukraine. One of the many reasons why that's an area of interest for the US,
and one of the reasons I think the Chinese and the Russians are working together,
right?
Yeah. Not separate. Anyway,
but that terrifies me that we have it was a bioweapon. There's clear evidence for it. What validated these documents to me, because I'd seen them, but I was like, is this a legitimate document? What validated it to me was Mike Pompeo, former head of the CIA and former Secretary of State for the US, tweeted that the US funded, he said, China should be held to account for letting the COVID-19 out of the Wuhan lab, but the United States organizations that funded its development should have been held accountable too. I'm like, what? Like, well, that confirms it. I don't know why this wasn't world news. But that confirms that he has no vested interest in blowing a whistle like that, a man of his position, unless it's absolutely
true.
And yet it was not reported at all.
Jeffrey Sachs is saying, because Jeffrey Sachs was
put
in charge.
That's terrifying to me.
Jeffrey Sachs was put in charge by the Lancet of looking into the origins.
I mean, such an impact that this
we
had.
We need to move on.
All right, so anyway, there's a whole lot of stuff to be mined out of that. Make your point quickly. Jeffrey Sachs, he appointed Peter Daszak to go to China to find out what had happened. But Daszak didn't bother to tell him that Eco Health Alliance, which he represented, had funded the very gain-of-function research that he was going to investigate.
So he put the criminal in charge of investigating
the crime.
Anyway, let's move on, please. Let's have a little chat now. Here from Sergei Lavrov, another interesting chap on this planet, talked about as the greatest chess player on planet Earth. But he was asked by a British journalist what he thought of the new Starmer government. It's only a very short clip, but he was very wise, I think, to reply in the way he does. I hope you can hear it because it's a little bit crackly. But this is Sergei Lavrov answering questions of what he thinks of our new government here.
Rishi Sunak tried to warn people in Britain that the UK would be weaker with Keir Starmer in charge. Do you think that's true?
I don't care. It's the British people.
Rishi Sunak said it's what Vladimir Putin wanted, Keir Starmer as Prime Minister. Is that true?
I told you that this is not our matter. It's the matter of the British people. And if the people found themselves where the Tories took them, it's up to them.
It's not our matter. Which is a great contrast, isn't it, to the Western attitude towards Putin has to go, Assad has to go, Gaddafi has to go. You know, it's not your matter. This is for the people in this country to decide who is their leader, not for you to decide, Western powers. And this is what, in fact, what they do is they repeat these things again and again and again. Putin has to go, the evil Putin needs to go. And after a while you start thinking, well, I suppose maybe he does have to go, maybe these annoying people he keeps saying he has to go will go away if he does go. And so you sort of get sucked into it, and that seems to be the game. But he's masterful there, really, in a way.
He's doing what British diplomats used to do, which is, it's not our position to tell you who to elect in your, he's coming out with... And of course, the other thing that the Russians realise, it doesn't really matter who we elect. I mean, they don't care whether it's Trump or Biden or Mickey Mouse. It won't make any difference. It won't.
The dual state is the one running the game, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a bit annoying from their point of view because they have to find out who they really need to talk to. But of course, Putin is... I mean, what the Russians have done is a fantastic achievement, because I used to go over there in the 90s. It was a basket case. The Yeltsin years were absolutely horrendous. It was far worse than Thatcherism here. Just horrific. Millions of people unnecessarily dead. The rate of, the life expectancy collapsed. It was already low, and it collapsed. But they've managed to turn that round, and they've developed a political system in which there's a full representation of political parties from far left
they've
to got, far
they've
right.
Built, they've brought respect back into politics. So that is to say, the people who are your government serve the interests of the people. Well, obviously, there are a few gangsters involved as well.
No, but the gangsters but are the much end more of the under day, control now than they were back in those days.
At the end of the day, it really is about... I mean, this is what Starmer keeps using, this word service, doesn't he? Actually, they're not. They're just a bunch of puppets. But anyway, Dan Jarvis is the new security minister. He's the one... That's the job that Tom Tugendhat, a Bilderberger, was earmarked for in the previous government. But anyway, so he's quite an important chappy, isn't he, Martin? Your security minister. Quite important. Anyway, so this week, this a couple of days ago, he was interviewed on Sky, where here we hear a little bit about this idea of is the UK having to be incredibly careful to avoid a Russian retaliation against the things we're doing with our military. So let's have a listen to this. Is a Sky report on with a bit of this new security minister Dan Jarvis on.
How worried should we be about any retaliation by Russia?
Well, of course we've got to guard against that, and of course we've got to be incredibly careful. But what's most important is that in concert with our NATO allies, we work together to make sure that President Zelensky and Ukraine have got the material support that they need to defend themselves against Russia. It is an illegal invasion, the consequences of which are massive for the whole of the world. And we stand shoulder to shoulder with our allies in doing what we can to support our colleagues in Ukraine.
Which is why we need an arms services review in sooner than a year.
Well, the Prime Minister and my colleague, the Defence Secretary, John Healey, have made a commitment that that review will be initiated very quickly. It's important that we follow the process and look carefully at the nature of the threat our country faces and the resources that will be required to put in place an armed forces that is fit for purpose.
But sooner than a year?
Well, it's an important process and it will take a period of months. The British Army is now smaller than at any point since the Napoleonic War. We need to look carefully at what capability will be required. That's a complex process, but we've made a commitment to get on with that as quickly as possible, okay. And that's what will happen.
So when top brass say a review of our armed services can be done in 6 weeks, they're wrong?
Well, the senior officers at the Ministry of Defence have got an incredibly important role to play as part of this process. But there does need to be a process. These are matters that the Prime Minister and the Defence Secretary are discussing. We're just a few days into the new Labour government, but the Prime Minister has made a very clear commitment that we will do this, that there will be a defence review and that will be initiated in the very near future.
Yeah, but if the top brass is saying you can do it in 6 weeks, we're being warned that World War III could be at the turn of the decade, and you're saying it's going to take a year before you even decide whether money's going to be spent.
Well, I'm not saying
that's
that.
It's quite alarming.
What I'm saying is that we need to do this properly. Our armed forces have been hollowed out in recent times. They are fundamental to our national security and our ability to defend ourselves, as well as other capabilities across the UK government. We need a proper process in place. We need a proper review to look at the changing nature of the threat. The world in which we live in is more dangerous, more complicated. The threats are greater, probably at any point since the end of the Second World War. So
that's Dan Jarvis there, the new security minister. He's very much, he doesn't really seem to have a particular vision, but they are going to have a defence review. He was kind of, in fact, funnily enough, it was the she started off chatting with him about the football of all things. Oh, well, did you enjoy the football, sir? sir, you know. By the way, isn't it it's Sunday? Isn't it? Oh God, Sunday. Yeah, are we. How can I just have a little on a tangent here? Do you think, you know, have we? It's Spain, I think. I'm apparently, out. We're playing.
Well, I mean, there was, you know, it's. The England team, especially since the last Euros, has become a unifying force in the society. So it's really quite nice.
Have they fixed it so that Starmer gets a feel-good factor?
That's what it looked like, because when they were going through the qualifications, it looked as if they were all over the place, and then the government changes and they start winning, you know.
That's what's in the COVID vaccine. It hurts the other teams. they can give you a little boost to help your politicians.
Yeah. They've got some.
Well, anyway, that's obviously. We'll have to see what happens.
You're worse than we are, Matt.
We'll have to see what happens on Sunday. I went and watched it in the Plough on Wednesday, which is, you know, where the Plough, being a sort of left-wing football pub, we didn't listen to the national anthem. We listened to God Save the Queen by the Sex Pistols when the teams are lined up.
Nice.
But anyway, I mean, what strikes me is how delusionary all this kind of talk is.
Yeah.
The Russians have got 1.25 million men under arms.
You get the idea that these people are just trying to have a go at Russia for the benefit of the Americans.
Well, it's just
the British public and the taxpayers don't even get a look in.
Yeah. Well, we're going to waste a lot of money on buying American kit, which is quite clearly rubbish. That's what all this boils down to. But of course, it's not just a boondoggle for the arms companies. There's also the danger that we could easily end up in a shooting war with the Russians, just as we're in a shooting war with the Yemenis at the minute, and we could end up in a shooting war with the Lebanon.
Yeah.
This could all happen.
What does that look like? I mean, they're a nuclear superpower. I mean, it looks like in 7 minutes, London is nuked.
Well, now, what they've got is these hypersonic missiles where they can fire from inside Siberia, and they could hit the naval base at Portsmouth.
Can I just ask both of
20
you
minutes.
With your educated guesswork? So imagine you've got some of these Storm Shadow missiles, some of Zelensky's little fellas with our British Special Forces helping them, haven't quite got the message from the Ministry of Defence that they're not allowed to use them to hit Russia. They hit a major Russia command base inside Russia with these things, and the Russians say, right, it's time to teach the Brits a lesson. Whereabouts do you think, Mike, maybe you first, Martin, and you, Matt, what might they do?
They're going to go for equivalent military targets. So if you've hit a Russian army base,
Well, I'm saying a command centre or something.
If they go for a command centre, then they'll go for command centres. You know, we're going to do it on your
northwards
soil.
In West London, a US NATO soil. Command centre.
Yeah. And they've said, look, we're reaching the point now where if you're going, you know, we really need to back down, but we're not doing it. And, of course, the real problem is, once these missiles stop, we couldn't fire back because we haven't got any of these hypersonic missiles. So, if we said, well, we're going to fire another one at you, we can only fire the Storm Shadows from Ukraine because they've only got a range of about maximum, 1,000 kilometres, something like that. The missiles the Russians have got can hit central...
Well, we've got ballistic missiles,
The Americans have got hypersonic missiles. No, they haven't.
But they're talking about haven't they?
No.
No, I thought
the Russians have achieved superiority in missiles. That's because they've got a nationalised arms industry, which actually works public. The generals decide what do we need, and they go away and make it.
So that's more efficient.
It's much more efficient. That's how they defeated the Germans in World War II. Because the communists
So Marx and socialism just wins.
There is something to be said.
If
you're going to have a war, you do need a bit of central planning.
Anyway, look, let's try and bring a little bit. I mean, I'm being silly myself, but let's try and bring a little bit of gravitas into this. Alistair Crook, he's a ex MI6 Martin, is he?
Diplomat, but he's a spooky former diplomat. He's probably MI6.
Talking to Judge Neapolitano here about this attack on Sevastopol on the beach with one of these cluster bombs being used to kill Russians in the beach in Sevastopol. So obviously that is not considered part of Russia by the West and by NATO. It's considered to be part of occupied Ukraine. Do you want to just say something about whether Sevastopol is occupied Ukraine?
That's
what we're saying.
It is, and that's wrong, because the whole of the Crimea was only put into the Ukraine on a whim by Khrushchev in 1954. Because it was to do with internal struggles within the communist part of the Soviet Union.
Well, maybe they were setting it up for the future, the Brits always did.
Well, no,
I think Kashmir.
The whole thing about Ukraine is it's a totally artificial state. The Ukraine just means, in Russian, Polish and Ukraine, it just means the borderland. And what you've got, and it was actually the borders of it were set by Lenin in the first place, then changed by Stalin at the end of World War II because they moved.
So you're saying no, basically. It's not really part of Ukraine.
No, they had referendums to leave Ukraine and
it's a Russian speaking area. Anyway, so let's have a listen to Alistair Crook now. I'm not quite sure of the guy that's doing the interview, but I just think, and it was a bit of a toss up this week between Scott Ritter, who also has you've got a new book out as well called, I think his book's called Covering Ukraine, 120 pages, so a nice easy read. And apparently it's already the bestseller on that part of Amazon, not the whole of Amazon, but that's as he keeps saying through the interview. But anyway, let's have a listen to Alistair Crook this week, giving us an idea about what he thinks is a massive game. You know, this attack on Sevastopol is changing a lot for the Russian attitude, and they're actually now looking at changing their nuclear doctrine as a result of killing those Russians on the beach the other week.
I think this was really a turning point, a very strong turning point. I would say we've seen two important shifts, can I call it, in the Russian zeitgeist, their sort of mental outlook on the world. The first occurred, because I was there just literally in the wake of it, I think it really occurred in the aftermath of the Crocus Concert Hall massacre. And I think at that point, the lingering sort of ideas of, the European inheritance that Russia has and that, we should, the old idea of going a larger, greater European project sort of disappeared at that point. And people actually just now feel, even if you go to St. Petersburg, I'm sorry you didn't get that, but you'd find people are still bitter, about not Biden or the government, but they're just bitter actually at what they hear coming from Europeans. I mean, they always thought understood Russia, and they say these extraordinarily Russophobic statements and demonizations of Russia, not just the government or anything, or Russian people, culture and everything else. I mean, their sports people, their culture, their image, everything sort of trashed. And so there was a shift there. And then I think now what's happened is I think the whole balance is now towards a harder line. altogether. I think that ultimately there's been a big debate, particularly about the nuclear issue within Russia. And I think it's now sort of slipped very much towards the sense that people are much more, not aggressive, but hard-nosed and saying, you know, we just have to rely on ourselves. We have to make our own security. We have to have our own system because, you know, we can forget the West for the next 10 years. Mm. Now, I mean, whether they're right or not, I mean, that's how people are feeling and seeing it. So I think, yes, it made a big impact. I mean, Russians were furious with that attack. I've looked at various traces of the sort of where the flight path should have come, if it was heading towards that airport or not. I think the jury is very much out on whether it was actually in some way a missile that was knocked off course or whether it shouldn't have been there at all. But anyway, it was there, and it created this big impact on Russian thinking. And so I think the message that we didn't hear or wasn't made explicit in the talk between Belousov and and Austin was, he said, warn him, you fly drones into the Black Sea from which you provide the electronic guidance and the support to these attackums and storm shadow missiles attacking into Crimea, into civilian targets in Belarus. We give you a warning. I mean, we will shoot them down. And I'm not suggesting that that applies yet to manned intelligence, AWACS-type aircraft, but I think it does apply to the drones. There's been huge pressure in Russia from ordinary people who say, look, if the Houthis can shoot down these American drones, I mean, why is it we don't do this? Because that's the eyes and ears of the NATO. Without that, they have no eyes and they have no ears to hear the radar traces, the radar, the chatter on the between aircraft and other things that they scoop up and feed back to the Ukrainians and to their team that is setting off the missiles. So I think it was a very serious message which came saying, now the question is, how's America going to react? I mean, are they going to then put fighter escorts to their drones and are we going to see it escalate? I think it's a good chance, and the Russians think there's a good chance. I think this is why we had such a serious speech from Mr. Putin at that foreign ministry talk. I think it was serious because of this. They've, you know, come to the view, and I think they are going to change, if you like, the doctrines on nuclear weapons. And easing is the wrong word, but redefine it to make it more appropriate if there is a sort of tit-for-tat escalations take place, that we will go. And actually, Putin says it could escalate to a nuclear exchange. But we hope that that means just a tactical one, if that's what we're talking about.
Well, you wrote in your piece this morning, or it came out just a day or two ago, that escalation is inevitable.
Yes.
Is that your view, or is that your understanding of the Russian view?
That is my very strong understanding of the Russian view, that escalation is for them almost inevitable. And not only that, now they are looking to the sense of what's happening in the Middle East. And they think that Russia becoming involved, and Russia said it is likely to get involved. They've talked about giving missile support to the Houthis. Even Hezbollah, not Putin, hasn't said this, but officials have been talking about some reciprocity in terms if America gives missiles to the Ukrainians to kill Russians, then there's no reason why Russia shouldn't give some of their missiles to other groups that can hurt American interests in nice symmetry. So, yes, I think that escalation is really expected. And I think they are also looking at the Middle East and seeing, you know, that if there is an invasion of Lebanon, which seems really to be gathering steam every day now from Israel, if there is some invasion of Lebanon, then, of course, it's likely that Israel will extend it to Syria because the Iranians are there and because the weapons supply routes pass through Syria.
Well, it's a pretty good go round the two main conflicts in the world by Alastair Crook there, former, well, you say he's a diplomat, I think he was MI6, who knows, maybe he denies it, but quite definitely involved in intelligence work as well, and doing quite a good job of linking, in fact, those two conflicts and looking at the change in Russian attitude. At some point, yes, they're going to kick back, aren't they?
Of course they are. I mean, they're in despair about how stupid the political elite in the West appears to be. You know, if they were led by rational people, you could see some deal being done here. You know, if people like Scott Ritter and Doug McGregor were actually running the US military, and people like General Michael Rose, who I went to see speak at Hay Festival some years ago. But what's happened is those kind of people who had some common sense have been pushed aside in favour of a lot of people who are just, you know, they're just not up to it in any way, shape or form, and they're delusional.
Well, they're yes men, aren't they?
That's right. I mean, Marchanov's blog, which I read, he's a Russian naval officer, former Russian naval officer. He actually lives in the United States. But he's just pointing out that the British and US militaries are just staffed by people who haven't got a clue about anything. You know, St. Patrick Sanders, who's now the retired head of the British Army, is saying that the Russian-Chinese-Iranian axis is worse than the Nazis, and we're going to have to bring back conscription, you know. And so this, you know, by the, you know, this delusion, you're already losing the war on the ground. The Russians are fighting.
What do you make, Matt? What do you make of this? It just sounds like these people are completely out of touch with the real world, deluded, and yet there's nothing to stop them.
I agree with the first part. I don't necessarily agree with the second part. I think it's always key to maintain our agency. We are 7.5 billion and there's a couple of thousand of these idiots. But I do think that they are fundamentally stupid. You know, I think we had this discussion at dinner the other night. So it was that I don't believe these people are evil. Kind of touched on that earlier. I just think they're misguided. They think they can maintain safety and security with these vicious policies. And, you know, they want to make us believe that China and Russia are the threats to world peace. I mean, what a joke. I mean, if you look at invasion, the US has been constantly dropping bombs, you know, for the last 60 years and invading about 60 countries. And China and Russia, really, they haven't been doing this at all. So why are we supposed to fear them? They seem much more sensible, much less petulant. I think ultimately the US ideology has spiraled out of control.
I wonder if it's a bit like living in 1930s Germany, watching your leaders become more and more rabid, and more insane. I mean, for example, talking of insane, over in Washington, the US President Joe Biden called the Russian leader Vladimir Putin a murderous madman. I mean, how do the Russians respond to something like that, Martin?
Well, the problem is, do they respond?
Is it best to just ignore things? Well, I mean, actually, what's happened, just looking here at RT, which we're not allowed to see in this country, apparently, Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesman, has said that the comments are unacceptable during a press conference following this week's NATO summit in Washington, which was last night. Biden stated some of the oldest and deepest fears in Europe had roared back to life because once again a murderous madman is on the march, referring to the Russian president. Biden suggested the Ukraine conflict has been a rude awakening to those who thought NATO's time had passed.
Well, I mean,
there were some other remarks he made as well, which we'll come to in a minute.
If they had any sense, you don't back people into a corner. You know, what do they do in police training and things like this? If you say somebody is Adolf Hitler, then you've got to go to war with them, haven't you? There's no other option. There is no possible option. Now, Saddam Hussein was a Hitler. Colonel Gaddafi was Hitler. not General Pinochet.
Well, Peskov is being quite sensible here, I think. He's saying that the Kremlin sees the US president's behaviour as absolutely unacceptable, impermissible for a head of state to say these things. He said the spokesman added that such statements do not paint the American leader in a good light, and he noted that Moscow continues to pay direct attention to such outbursts. He also asked, was also asked to comment on the numerous gaffes that plagued Biden's speech during the summit, including mixing up Russia and Ukraine, announcing Ukraine's Vladimir Zelensky as President Putin, and referring to former President Donald Trump as the US Vice President instead of Kamala Harris. The spokesman said, "We have paid attention to the fact the whole world has paid attention to this, but stated that Moscow can offer no other comments on this matter other than saying it's clear that these are slips of the tongue." So before any more, I think we should hear Joe Biden's string of gaffes that he's been making, and where we can comment after that about the suitability of this man to be the great leader of the Democratic West.
And now I want to hand it over to the president of Ukraine, who has as much courage as he has determination. Ladies and gentlemen, President Putin.
President Putin.
You're going to beat President Putin. President Zelensky. I'm so focused on beating Putin, we got to worry about it. Anyway, Mr. President.
I'm better.
You are a hell of a lot better.
What concerns do you have about Vice President Harris's ability to beat Donald Trump if she were at the top of the ticket?
Look, I wouldn't have picked Vice President Trump to be vice president, but I think she was not qualified to be president. So let's start there. Number one, the fact is that the consideration is that I think I'm the most qualified person to run for president. I beat him once, and I will beat him again. I'm ready to deal with him now and 3 years from now. Look, like I said, I'm dealing with Xi right now and direct contact with him. I have no good reason to talk to Putin right now. There's not much that he is prepared to do in terms of accommodating any change in his behavior. And but there isn't any world leader I'm not prepared to deal with. But I understand that a generic point is Putin ready to talk? I'm not ready to talk to Putin unless Putin's ready to change his behavior. Last time I talked to Putin was trying to get him to work on an arms control agreement related to nuclear weapons in space. That didn't go very far. I've taken three significant and intense neurological exams by a neurologist. In each case, as recently as February, and they say I'm in good shape, okay? Although I do have a little problem with my left foot because it's not as sensitive because I broke my foot and didn't wear the boot, but I'm good. I've got to finish this job. I've got to finish this job because there's so much at stake. And if you look at my schedule since I made that stupid mistake in the debate, I mean, my schedule has been full bore.
You earlier explained confidence in your vice president.
Yes.
If your team came back and showed you data that she would fare better against former President Donald Trump, would you reconsider your decision to stay in the race?
No, unless they came back and said, there's no way you can win. Me. No one's saying that. No poll says that.
No poll says that. Oh, yeah, you're going to win. Okay, so there's a pretty amazing litany there. It's great to have a little bit of something to lighten the mood, isn't it? Mm. Listening to the... when he says, yeah, when I made that mistake, yeah, which mistake? Which mistake? He's making mistakes all the time. In fact, it was comedy gold. As soon as he went off script, because he's reading an auto cue, teleprompter, the Americans call them, in his speech, then he has something like half an hour having to think on his feet, and he immediately gets it all wrong by talking about his vice president as Donald Trump rather than Kamala Harris. So clearly this guy's got to go. I suppose there's several things to say about this. One is, why has it taken the American press so long to wake up to the fact that this guy is useless? Matt,
It's not that they're not aware. It's just convenient for the system, you know, because they're not a free independent press. It's, you know, they're completely embedded into the security state, directly and indirectly, to serve the same interests. And
maybe it's the same gravy train that Keir Starmer's on.
It is. It's a gravy train, and Pitts win prizes and all the rest. But I think it's clearly it's a joke. I mean, Zelensky himself was literally a comedian. You can look that up on YouTube. Yeah. Some of those clips. I mean, it makes me think. So you listen to Putin; he actually talks a lot of sense. I think that US at the moment are in a desperate situation. If you look at, and that's why they're doing, behaving as badly as they are. It's escalating. And if you look at it, their inflation is now far beyond what it was before the last crash, magnitudes. And I think that's why they're doubling down on places like Ukraine and Palestine, which they hold another thing in common. I heard that recently that Ukraine is the most fertile, land, resource rich land in Europe. And Palestine is, oh yeah, the most resource rich land in the Middle East. Gosh, what a coincidence. How could it be that we need to fight for democracy in those two areas so badly? I think the US is desperate, and that's why they're
so
blindly,
who's gonna
blindly going
to actually run for
these.
The Democratic Party, both of you? Who do you think's actually going to take over? Is it just going to be Kamala Harris or Hillary Clinton? Is she going to pop her nose up in again? But clearly this guy is absolutely useless.
And it's interesting
because
RFK,
loads of the discussion at the NATO conference and the discussion with the press there is about his suitability to stand. Very little to do with the strategic situation with the Russians possibly going to retaliate.
Mm. Yeah, well, as Katie Johnson, who's an Australian, said, what's been astonishing about this is the liberal press in the US is debating about whether Biden can win an election. What they should be debating is, why is he in charge at all? You know, he's actually in charge right now, this minute, and we're on the brink of World
Ultimately,
War III.
Ultimately, they don't even care that much, because Trump and Biden are two cheeks of the same. I think Trump is slightly better in terms of being less of a NATO war monger. He does actually. The one thing I like about Trump, which is there is not a lot, believe me, is that he is less in favor of the forever war game, and that's why he's less favored by the media. Mm-hmm. Frankly, now I don't like the guy in many respects. Like I say, left after the same. There's another candidate who could beat Trump in polls, and that's RFK Jr. Yeah. And I suggest everyone really look into his policies. They are awesome.
Does he stand a chance in Democratic
politics?
He's
an outside chance, but he
he's
could,
the obvious guy, isn't he? If there was a democracy, he's the obvious guy. That's, you know, right. A bit of a modern day Jimmy Carter
problem,
type. Although of course he's very very pro
Israel. Is like all three of them very very pro.
But you can't apparently stand any chance of getting anywhere in US politics unless you are.
Yeah, and so that's the biggest caveat of him around Israel, and that's totally fair enough. A lot of people have jumped off his bandwagon because of that. It's a difficult spot he's in. I think he's been placed in the really tough spot. Yeah. But if you look at his policies, if you can put that massive thing in the box for just a minute, look at his policies. I think he delivers a tool set of everything you need if you're someone who wants to have a world of justice.
So let's see
and end
if there is
wars.
Any democracy. RFK. No, Martin, we've just got to come to the end now.
Well, I was just saying Jill Stein is also in the race.
Oh, she's fantastic.
And, of course, both Hodgson
and
Kucinich
she's
have,
on the right
have transferred
side of history on
their
Israel.
Loyalty to her.
Yeah,
say something about her,
too, but I think
she's Jewish, and she went down to the Washington State University where they're having an occupation, and she got arrested. Yeah.
Mm. Ah, right.
Oh, look, she's great. I've got a lot of love for her. I hope I'm wrong, but I think she's far too much of a long shot.
Am I right in thinking that really there's no way Biden can carry on because he can't even get the name right.
He'll definitely lose if he
mixes
runs.
Up his opponent with his vice president. I mean, you know, he mixes up Putin and Zelensky. This is just unbelievable, really. Anyway, look, let's have a listen to something a little bit more positive again, too, because these shows can be a bit depressing when we're going into how awful our leaders are, how vile and disgusting the accelerationist policies are. The idea that, you know, you create a crisis and cynically come up with another thing which is even worse in order to solve the crisis is going to make things worse. It's not going to solve it at all. So this is cynicism and really negative philosophy involved in leadership to really spread chaos, basically, so that because they believe they can bring order from chaos, and that's their way. But over in the States, there are several people standing in the political system who do speak out really well. And here's one. His name is Jose Vega. He's standing in New York politically against the traditional parties. And here he is at some, I think it's in, yeah, it's in New York City. And it's a convention, which I think is talked about by the guy that's doing the commentary here. But just have a listen to this guy go. And he gets strangled and dragged out of the meeting.
US Warhawk Matt Pottinger was on stage doing his normal thing, demonising the Chinese to justify an attack on them, when audience member Jose Vega stood up and spoke the simple truth. The world's problems are not caused by China, but by a warmongering US elite. The Chinese model of exporting cooperation is better than the US model of fostering division and conflict, wars. Now, this incident took place on July the 2nd at an Asia Society event. Listen to what Vega actually said.
I'm supposed to believe that Xi Jinping is this evil dictator when the United States is actually responsible for a three-front world war? Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, the three fronts of World War III, and idiots like you are trying to tell me China is the actual responsible one for World War III? I'm supposed to believe China is surveilling our kids? We have a mass surveillance state here. We call fascism, okay? The NSA spies on everything we do. You think I give a shit if Xi Jinping cares about what I'm doing? The United States government already spies on me. This incoherent idiot up on the stage is no different than the incoherent babbler named Biden, who probably isn't running our government. Okay, I can't believe Richie Torres has you come and testify at our government, in our Congress. You're a disgrace, okay? There is an alternative to the world right now. We don't need to have World War III. We can actually work with China. Did you know that? We can work with China. Every time they come, they offer a peaceful solution. Listen,
calm down,
come. Don't start World War III. He's choking me. He's choking me. Holy shit.
Stand up.
Jesus Christ.
Stand
he just
up.
Choked me.
Stand up.
Jesus. Hey, my neck really hurts, man.
Nobody's choking.
Oh. Oh. I can't breathe. Hey.
All right. Stand up.
Jesus Christ. What the f- hey, I'm not done talking about peace, man. You can't manipulate the American population anymore. People will not fall for your antics. We can join the BRICS. We can work with the people. The fascism and the tyranny has to end here. We don't need to go to war. I'm pleading with people. I'm pleading with the American population. Don't listen to the idiots on stage. You have fascism in your own country. Don't let them take you to World War III.
So that's the wonderful Jose Vega from New York. And he did quite well after he got strangled, didn't he? He managed to carry on and do a whole nother round. But the first time I come across him, I think we should seek him down. Maybe we could have a live interview with the guy. Hopefully he won't be shouting and ranting so much. But certainly, you know, he's got...
As long as he speaks the truth like that.
Well, that's he's got the guts to go and speak truth to power. This is where... I mean, this is why you get the elite institutions, whether they're universities, media, politics, government, big business... They seal themselves off in their ivory towers so that Jose Vega can't get anywhere near them. And if he did, of course, they might have to think about what they're doing rather than just, you know, in their own little cliques, deciding to help each other to get a little bit more money and prestige and success on their stupid gravy train, which the mass media then come along and pat them all on the back and say, oh, you're doing a great job, which is, I suppose, the purpose. And that's why most of our young people don't watch any mainstream media. It's why Matt here probably doesn't read much mainstream media at all.
Try to read it.
Because they've got it all wrong. Anyway, sorry not for not using the House of Lords ceremonial this week. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. For any of you who are curious to hear the strange things that go on in our arcane houses of parliament under the orders of the king, who apparently signs bits of paper but he cannot himself attend in person, to open a new parliament. I think if we just wind up by maybe Martin, maybe you can say something about this idea of actually taking this fight to these kinds of meetings, where, I mean, we were hearing from Matt earlier on about going along to some meeting Petraeus at some public meeting and actually trying to speak to these people directly.
Well, Code Pink do that quite a lot in the US. And it's a tactic, but of course you've got to get in there, and you've got to, because they'll make sure that you don't get in. I went to a seminar in the London School of Economics many years ago now, soon after 9/11, about 3 weeks after 9/11, and there was a US political attaché from the US Embassy, Mort Dworkin III, he was there, and I paid to go in. And of course, because you've paid to go in, yeah, the riffraff are kept out. So I tried to talk to him, and I couldn't get a word in. And then, of course, I tried to talk...
What do you mean? Did you try to ask a question during the meeting?
I was trying to put my hand up to say stuff.
But they were ignoring you?
Yeah, about because the deputy director of the FBI, John O'Neill, had resigned in the July 2001 because he said the Bush family was protecting bin Laden. And he in fact, ended up as being head of security in the World Trade Center. And he was his first day in his job when it came down, and he was killed. John O'Neill, who's a US Irish New Yorker, yeah. So, in other words, we knew straight away that something wrong with all of this. But anyway, he hung around inside. So I chatted to everybody on the outside. I was thrown out by the security. So I had some leaflets handed out, and I handed out to everybody who was inside. And they were mostly quite liberal people. Bonnie Greer is a writer who lives over here. I had a chat with her. Anyway, he waited inside, and I thought he must have gone out the back way. But eventually, he came out. And I went straight up to him and said, you do realise the deputy director of FBI resigned in July because he said Bush was protecting bin Laden, don't you? He said, yeah, John O'Neill, we know. I said, well, we know too, matey, and don't you forget it. But that you can sometimes get in there.
You weren't being all that friendly with him, though, Martin, are you? This is the idea. Matt is saying, look, the thing is, just go and have a gentle chit-chat with these guys.
No, it depends, doesn't it? It depends.
That's not an offensive thing you said, though. You said
That's good. And of course, he knew exactly what I was talking about.
Nowadays, you can record it like Code Pink then it can be more impactful. And I was more or less able to do it. I got some photographs of Petraeus, and it spreads, it has a bigger resonance. So that's why I believe in the potential of social media to really boost our, you know, decentralizing power. But yeah, I mean, broadly, we've got to get off the US's I think they're a crumbling empire. BRICS has already got a bigger economic basis, and it's only going to get more substantial. But I do look at Russia and China as they don't seem to be this warmongering. I look at America as sort of a petulant teenage empire, whereas China's been around for eons, you know. And they haven't been this invasive, you know, cancerous, you know, entity on the world like the US. And we've been embedded with them in the UK, you know, and in the West. But if you look at it, they're becoming desperate, and they're becoming more dangerous. And I think we've got to draw a line and look at being independent from that, push back on these crazy policies, because it is going to blow back into World War III, which will be nuclear holocaust. There's no survivors of that. You got to pay attention when Putin's talking about nuclear escalation, and it is inevitable. You just can't go to war with a nuclear superpower like that. It's far too dangerous, and the fact that they're considering this shows you know, we've got to get off this.
Problem is that, you know, back in the 1960s, there were a whole load of US hawks who really did want to start a nuclear war. They tried to start a nuclear war. They did things, this is in the Cuban Missile Crisis, they did things like fire a test missile over the Bering Straits towards Russia, towards the Soviet Union, even though it was actually a test. Yeah. They were told Strategic Air Command had taken over all the test missiles so they could put real warheads in them in case there was a war. But this one was left because it was scheduled to be tested during the crisis. And they said, oh, well, it's only a test one, but we'll fire it off anyway and see that. Because that one missile heading towards the Soviet Union could have been a real nuclear weapon. The Russians could have thought, right, here they come, we're going to have to hit them back. So these guys really didn't want to start a nuclear war. They did everything they could to start it. from behind the scenes. We're talking about Curtis Lee May, is it? And Thomas Power, this great name for this complete strategic air command maniac. They saw the Cuban Missile Crisis as an opportunity to attack the Soviet Union because the Russians were closing the missile gap. So the Americans at that point had more missiles. The Russians had less, but the Russians were building more. So they said, right, before they catch up with us, we need to attack them, nuclear attack, so that they can never catch up with us, because we know we will win because we've got more than them. These are the sort of maniacs that were around in the 1960s, and it seems we've got quite a lot of those hanging around at the time. Now,
well, I don't know if everyone knows, but the doomsday clock, you know, has been set to the closest it's been to midnight ever. It's now 90 seconds to midnight. Do you know that?
Come on, say something to cheer us up. Come on, at the end
Well,
of the show.
There is hope in that there is these multipolar, you know, BRICS, and you know, there's going to be a balance.
Yeah.
As you say,
it might
get
very
China
nasty, but ultimately, I mean, this
doesn't have to.
When it might well do, and it almost certainly will do, get extremely nasty.
Yeah.
But I think in the end, and I got this sense from the Palestinian restaurant we were at during the week, is that these guys are going to win. You meet the Palestinians, you say, yeah. They've got what it takes. They've got whatever it took to beat Hitler in the underground in Europe in World War II. These same sort of people, they're impossible to beat. However many drones you throw at them, forget it. And so I think maybe we'll finish this week with Iqbal Mohammed, who's the newly elected independent MP for Dewsbury and Batley. Well done, you Yorkshire folk, for electing an independent pro-Palestinian MP above the main uniparty, because there are five independent pro-Palestinian candidates, including Labour Party leader, former leader Jeremy Corbyn, have won in the UK general elections, with Israel's war on Gaza their key issue for voters. Other four independent candidates who won their seats from Labour on last Friday include Shokat Adam in Leicester South, Ayub Khan in Birmingham Perry Bar, Adnan Hussein in Blackburn, and the chap we're going to hear from now, Iqbal Mohammed, finally, in Dewsbury and Batley.
Our democracy has been hijacked by the corrupt, racist, pro-war, apartheid, genocide-supporting elite. And Dewsbury and Batley have spoken. We have taken our democracy back. And we will do the same across the United Kingdom. I am honoured and humbled to be elected to represent the people of Dewsbury and Batley and for the people of our country. On the platform for global peace, justice, equality and the service to our constituents, our country and to the wider world and for humanity, we stand united with humanity. I am here as a human being first. I stand here in solidarity with the Palestinian people and all people advocating for peace and justice around the world. I appeal with all my being to the new government, to our new Prime Minister, as well as to all my fellow MPs that have been chosen by the people, for the people. Our country has a national and global duty and responsibility to advocate and promote peace and justice in our nation and around the world. Our government has an obligation to adhere to British and international laws at all times and to protect life here and around the world. There are other more prominent and experienced speakers who have given you the message of what the government needs to do, but I stand here representing the people of Dewsbury and Batley, who are overwhelmingly demand an immediate ceasefire and to provide immediate emergency aid to save lives and to begin the rebuilding of a free Palestinian state.
Yeah, so he's going to win. That's what I'm saying. It's people like this are going to win. And it's, I suppose, the job of idiots like Tommy Robinson to try to get and make people think, oh, this guy's an immigrant, he's going to Muslim, they're trying to take over. No. This is the great British spirit, and it's come out in Batley. All those people that have voted for this anti-genocide candidate, well done to all of them. So, Matt, you just wanted to round up by talking a little bit about the Julian.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, all this NATO sort of warmongering, it serves US interests. It doesn't serve, certainly, the rest of the world, and it doesn't really serve England's, you know, and I think if we're going to, of course, we can still have partnerships with the US, but we don't have to be part of this warmongering NATO alliance. NATO's job is finished when, you know, apparently when the Berlin Wall collapsed and we were not supposed to move any further than Berlin. And now NATO has surrounded Russia, and it's just a joke. They're just poking a nuclear bear, and we don't want any part of that. I think it's gone far enough. We've got to get off that. But fundamentally, if we're going to be allies with the United States and this security elite, the hard line has to be that we represent the rule of law and democracy. And to me, that line has now been fully crossed. I'm not talking about a corrupt democracy anymore. It's an absolute tyranny when you have a law, the Espionage Act, that can jail somebody, anybody, a journalist, anybody, for revealing evidence of horrific state crimes, horrific crimes. Once that prison is there and also is being applied in Britain, extraterritorially, they all claim to being a democracy is gone. So I implore the United States to burn the Espionage Act, just stick to your principles, be a democracy, we can all be friends and get along, but you're losing your moral authority, and it's time to come back to.
I think all the people understand that, don't they? This is maybe why they decided to start building these massive factories full of drones, because they know that the people would never fight for them.
Mm. Well, there we go. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to Matt O'Brannan. Yeah.
That's right. Irish Socialist Kiwi activist.
Irish Socialist Kiwi, okay. Also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Amazingly, we've managed to find ourselves a place for a little while here. Hopefully, much more comfortable than last week in the corridor. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. Just follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram too. Please do send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. If you can afford it, you can even donate or set up a small monthly sub at thisweekoneword.org.uk. So here's wishing you a relaxing an enjoyable weekend. We've been streaming live from the Eastone Studios in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, radiosoapbox.com in Worthing in East Sussex, and live on Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know on FM or AM as well, and we'll credit you here. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. Think of others before yourself. Don't get sucked into the zero trust agenda, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Wrong. peeking, peeping, hiding out down the street. See my life shaking with every who I meet. Refried confusion as I'm making itself clear. Wonder which way do I go to get on out of here? Cause I've been in the right place, but it must have been the wrong time. And I done said the right thing, but it must have used the wrong line. I took the right road, but it must have took a wrong train. I took the right move, but I made it at the wrong time.
Selling, teachers are selling, the government is selling too. the doctors and the lawyers and the bookers and the soldiers, the musicians are selling too. Money is not good here in America. Money is not good here in America. Are you living for a government that's higher than all? Or do you want to be like them? You won't sell your soul for some rice in your bowl, or maybe for a little yen. And you succumb to the lie, you won't stand in line. We'll need to do a tragic game. So much will be lost if you can't pay the cost, and the door will be your soul, my friend. Money is a good here in America. Money is a good here in America. Oh yes. Money is a god here in America. Money is a god here in America. They'll be wheeling and a dealing and a robbing and a stealing. They would do it to the mothers too. They'll spread it to the notion all across the ocean. Half of what they leave their future. Money is a god here in America. 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 You know it's true.